discuss is methodology in thinking. Okay? Now, all ideas, concepts, theories, definitions are all abstracting from a certain subject that you have in front of you. You have a subject, and you abstract certain ideas. Okay? The mind will naturally do this. In other words, most people will give interpretations or give causes of why things happen. You got a cold? Why'd you get a cold? Because you didn't wear your galoshes. You know? So the thing is that everybody thinks in terms of causes, and they give reasons or principles or concepts for the different things, okay, for the different phenomena that they're looking at. The difference between them and the scientist is the scientist works on perfecting that part of the mind to be able to clarify the definitions. Do is to start, do that in this group, for this class. How? Very simple. King Solomon said that the proverbs are for beginners. What are the proverbs? Proverb is a statement of a certain fact about life, right? And then we abstract the concept or idea of how it really works. That's really what we're doing. We're doing the same thing that any theorist in physics, math, or any other science does. We're doing it about life. We just have a different subject. But however, we have to do the same thing, where we see the facts, and then we abstract the concept. The same thing if we want to know how God operates. So we read the Chumash, and it's not just to remember this or that story. It's to abstract the concept of how God operates in certain situations and how He relates to us in different situations. So therefore, this method becomes very, very important for us if we're going to study through Torah and to get the ideas of what God wants to get across to us. So therefore, this method of thinking becomes very important, and it becomes very important to be precise in this so you shouldn't make any mistakes, because any mistakes means a mistake about God. Mistake in ethics, so then you're going to run your life in an incorrect manner. Therefore, by definition, you'll have to fail. What I propose for this class is that every week we will give a proverb. And that'll be for homework. And during the week, you'll work on it. And then you will come back to class, give over what you say, and we'll try to guide you either way you see it or where you're making mistakes, and slowly but surely to learn how to define the proverbs. And from there, build up to other areas in Torah to do the same thing, but first to learn the method. With the proverb, I'd just like to give you one starting point. When you're analyzing a proverb, always start with your questions. Even if you can't answer the questions, you should be trained to ask the questions, because the question is the guide. If you just jump to answers like, why, what's forcing you to go that way? So therefore, always start with the questions, and let your questions be your guide. If you ask one question, somebody asks another question, sometimes to guide you in different ways. So as many questions as is possible to see, that should be the start. And even if you don't have answers, if you just learn to question, that's also an important point. But you must have the guide, and the guide is the questions. So always look for any type of inconsistency or any type of thing that is not clear. Okay? The proverb that we're going to do is in chapter 10, verse 6 in Proverbs. And the proverb is a blessing to the head of a righteous man, and the mouth of the wicked hides or conceals violence. Is that there are different commentaries on the different verses. And the reason is the way they translate the verse. You see? Now, I'm reading in English in one particular way. Somebody might put the syntax or some other thing or a translation slightly different, which means it would have a whole different proverb. It maybe will come the value is if you know Hebrew, and then you start learning how to read the Hebrew, and then from the different commentaries, learn how to look at it from different angles. So that would be another analysis, which you don't have if you don't have the Hebrew. Okay? So all we're doing is taking the proverb. I have translated it. If you knew the Hebrew, then there would be another discussion of how to formulate the proverb to begin with. That also becomes an analysis. You see? So, but the thing is that without Hebrew, we'll just have the proverbs. Official, if a person can learn Hebrew and go back to the original text, there's a benefit in that. To do your homework in this area, you should not try to force answers. You should allow what comes to the mind naturally, the questions or insights, whatever it is, you are taking steps. Just enjoy the process. If you try to find answers, you're going to force yourself to take answers that you might have to skip steps to get the answer. That's harming you because you're skipping steps. You're training yourself to skip steps. Therefore, don't push any answer. Just allow the natural mind to take its steps, whether it's a question or an insight, a partial answer, an answer that you yourself disagree with, that's also fine. Whatever the mind, just enjoy it. Don't look for answers. Let the answers come. And just allow yourself to think about the statement that we gave and how you view it. It makes no difference right or wrong. Just enjoy the process. Okay? The possibility is, we're talking about blessing to the head of a righteous man, and the mouth of the wicked hides violence. Okay? Now, Doug wants to say that the possibility of blessing to the head of the righteous means that the righteous will receive blessing from others, right? And the mouth of the wicked hides violence. And they're dealing with others, even though they say one thing, but their intent is another. Artist, right? He says nice things, but however, he has intent to harm you. Okay? Now, what is the connection between the first half of the verse and the second half of the verse? They seem to have different subjects. That's because the first half is talking about that the result of living a righteous life is you will get blessings from other people. By blessing, the means, the way you're translating blessing now is that you'll be praised. Okay? The people will praise the righteous for his righteous acts. But however, the second half is saying that even though the wicked talk nice, like a con artist, he speaks very nicely to you, but he really, his intent is to harm you. So therefore, the first half of the verse and the second half of the verse have nothing to do with each other. In a problem like this, there are two approaches. One approach is either you're totally wrong and you might as well start off on a new approach of the verse, or it is possible that you have to clarify or maybe change part of the verse. You understand? In other words, like you gave two different subjects. First half has one, the second half has another. Maybe you could work it out. You could keep one subject and not the other. Or maybe through a certain twist of understanding, the way you understand it, you could bring them together into one subject. In other words, just because you have a question doesn't mean your total approach is wrong. It means either it's totally wrong. A question could either mean that what you're saying is totally wrong, and therefore you have to look for a new approach altogether. Or sometimes you can subdivide or work it out. We'll see how it works as we go along, the exact way that we operate. But the thing is, sometimes it could be you could fix up the whole thing and keep part of it. That that he harms others. That could be a con artist. He sells you something that really is not good. So therefore, he's harming you. It doesn't mean violence physical. It doesn't necessarily have to mean physical violence, even though it could mean physical violence, that he's hiding a way of harming you, inviting you someplace to harm you physically. It's any type of harm, whether it's monetary harm or physical harm. It's some type of harm. What I'm trying to discuss now is what does it mean to the head of a righteous man? What does it mean to the head of? Your own answers, then you should go back and check the answers by seeing if you can formulate questions. The Meiri, a medieval interpreter of Talmud and parts of Tanakh, of the Torah, of the written Torah, so he says that the only test for these ideas is questions. And you should question a subject. It should look as if your desire is to break it down, even though your desire should not be to break it down, but your desire is just to search for truth. And therefore, you must question it to make sure that you're getting the correct interpretation. The correct interpretation should not be able, there should be no questions left when you finish with your interpretation. So I'm basically saying is that the subject has to do with the benefits, like a blessing is a benefit. In other words, it's a benefit to the righteous, how he thinks, right? And it's a harm to the wicked, right, of the way he operates. Is that correct? There are two steps in analyzing Proverbs. The first step in analyzing Proverbs is to try to understand the verse itself. Later on, once you have clarity in the verse, then there's another check, and that is, does this work in the physical world? Does it actually happen in the physical world? That's a second type of question that you would have. But right now we're dealing only with the analysis of the verse and not the reality outside whether it does happen or not. That will come later once we've clarified the verse. The second half does not talk about the wicked, but the mouth of the wicked. We're not talking about the wicked. In other words, what state they're in, whether a good state or a bad state. We're talking, the subject is the mouth of the wicked. That's where you run into trouble between the first half and the second half. You see? In other words, the first half seems to be talking about, according to you, is that there's some benefit in the way he thinks. Right? There's some benefit in the way the righteous thinks. Okay? So then you want to say so then based on that, you want to interpret the second half. You say, but the words of the second half is not saying that. You see? Right? Okay. I'd like to explain a little bit about this. When you run into a problem where the first half and the second half does not fit at all, then what you're really asking, when you ask the question, what does the first half have to do with the second half? What you're really asking is, what is the subject matter? Now, what's going to happen is, since you're dealing with two statements, one statement should have one subject matter, and the other statement should have another subject matter. That's the problem. In other words, according to Doug, the first statement is that other people will bless the righteous. They'll be accepted and recognized by other people. The second half, the subject again, is that a con artist, like we said before. According to Kim, a blessing to the head of the righteous is that we're talking about his state of mind. But again, the second half is only talking about a con artist. So in both cases, we have two subject matters. And somehow we can't work out what the subject of the whole verse is. So far, is that we're still stuck on what one half has to do with the other half, and you're trying to fit the second half into the first half. What if we tried the second half, that subject, and see if that could fit into, somehow the first part could fit into the second half subject, to change the subject as of yet, of the second half. And we're still saying that the mouth of the wicked hides violence, means that we're talking about a con artist. Mainly that he says one thing, but his motive is to harm you. Okay? That's still the subject of the second half. Question is, can that subject somehow fit into the first half? The question is the mouth of the wicked hides violence, or even a con artist, saying a con artist, is the description. But the question is what is the subject of this description? Mouth is secrets. In other words, the wicked, they keep secrets, right? That's what the subject of the second half is, the secrets. That he says one thing, but he has in mind another, and he keeps the secrets of other what his real motive is. To the head of a righteous man, we are talking about a secret that a righteous man also keeps secrets. Okay? But the secrets that a righteous man keeps is for the benefit of others. For instance, sometimes he'll keep a secret that he'll know because it could hurt you, it could do harm to you. Or sometimes there's some knowledge that you're not ready for, and he might not give you that knowledge because it'll harm you. He has secrets too. But however, his secrets is a blessing, meaning that it's a benefit to everybody concerned, because his secrets are a benefit. So the subject is really secrets of both halves. This verse is the first half was too vague, and the ways we translate it, even though possible, in and of itself, would have fit in well. But however, they did not work out well with the second half. So therefore, what we did is we took the subject of the second half and see if that subject could fit in to the words, not by changing words. Now, the head of a righteous man, to the head of a righteous man, could definitely mean in his head, what's in his head. And since the subject matter is secrets, it means that the righteous man also has secrets in his head. But the secrets that he keeps is a blessing, meaning that it's a benefit for him to keep these secrets. And now the words fit in also. The words of a blessing to the head of a righteous man fits in. But the reason why we have, what forced us to explain it, was the original question of what does one subject have to do with the other of the two halves. We have to have one subject to the two halves. And so therefore we got to the interpretation via the second half of the verse. Distinction, but it is always in one subject. Here the subject is secrets. And so the two halves of the verse are dealing with the righteous and the wicked. And so how there are two ways of handling secrets. And to the head of, is it's a benefit, that which is to the head, in other words, which is in the head of the righteous, which is in the head. It's a benefit, translating a blessing as meaning a benefit. And that a benefit to the head over here means what's in his head. First half, it could come out many different interpretations. Some might even be closer to the word, possible. But however, because of the second half, which is so clear of what the subject is, that it has to be, the first half has to be, that it is a benefit to the head, meaning what's in the secrets that are in the head of the righteous man. It has to be that way. Questions, you see? The key is to find the question that's a guide. Then all the other questions will be answered when you finish the analysis. But the main thing is to get in this verse, the key was, what is the subject matter? That was the key guide. Okay? So you must have a lot of questions, but a lot of questions only show that you don't know what it's talking about. Then how you find the key to guide you. In every verse, it's different. 10, again, in Mishlei, and it's verse 4, and it says, a poor person makes a fraudulent weight, while the hand of the diligent becomes wealthy. By a fraudulent weight, it means they used to measure a pound, they used to have these weights, and if he would make the pound stone little less than a pound, that's the way you would cheat. Okay? So a poor person makes a fraudulent way, while the hand of the diligent becomes wealthy. That's homework for next week.
These are Kim's questions on the proverb.
A poor person makes a fraudulent way, while the hand of the diligent becomes wealthy. I'm wondering if the person is poor because they make a fraudulent way, or if they're just a poor person and this is something that they do.
And
it says they make a fraudulent weight, but it doesn't say they necessarily used it. It's just saying that's how they spend their time.
That's it?
Yeah.
Okay. The questions that I had were, what is the person poor in? Are we talking about monetary wealth, or are we talking about something else? When it says a diligent becomes wealthy, wealthy in what? I had difficulty trying to determine what the subject of the verse was, because the statement a poor person makes a fraudulent weight gave an implication to me that poor people are always dishonest, and that didn't seem like it was true in the real world, so I was having difficulty with the juxtaposition.
The question that Doug asked, what does poor person mean, poor in what? There are always the two levels in interpreting Proverbs. One is on the literal level, and two on the metaphorical level. We should always try to interpret it first on the literal level. If we have a proof that it's literally impossible to be so, if we have such questions to show that it's impossible to have any meaning on the literal sense, it totally contradicts reality totally, then we must interpret it on the metaphorical sense. So we should always start on the literal sense. So therefore, we're going to take the proverb, a poor person, poor always means monetarily. Right. The second question, which Doug asked, was a poor person makes a fraudulent weight, is, he says, not all poor people do this. This seems to be universal. And he's asking the question that not all poor people do this. Is that correct? I was already asked. I would like to add one more. And that is that poor and diligent have nothing to do with each other. They're not opposites. Mm-hmm. So the question is, what is the subject of the proverb? Okay? I'd like to first take Doug's question about poor... that not all poor people, not all poor people are crooks. Now the thing is that when there's two types of questions that you have on Proverbs. One is the verse itself doesn't make sense, and since the proverb must be applicable to everyday life, so sometimes the question is like Doug's question is that it doesn't work. You're making a universal statement that poor people make fraudulent weights, and that is not true. Not all poor people are crooks. So the thing is therefore because of that, we must say that King Solomon, his style was to write it universally, but however, he must have realized that fact too. So therefore, he realized you would question it, and therefore you would subdivide. Okay? You would say that he must be poor, right? There's a certain type of poverty, you see, that will cause a person to be fraudulent or crooked. Okay? Now the question is, what type of poverty and what type of poor person, like you said, like you asked the question also, that a poor person doesn't cause you to be, you know, or like Kim asked, is it the poor person that makes you poor, or is it the poverty, you know what I mean, makes you poor and then you become a crook? So the thing is that what I really think what's happening here is that he is poor because of something within him, and therefore he becomes a crook, you see? Now the thing is, I also have a proof from the verse. What's the proof? Because we ask, what does the first half have to do with the second half? Therefore, we're asking, what's the subject? Now, if I ask you, what is the subject of the verse, what would you say?
if we can't talk about the subject, what are the two opposites that we're dealing with? In other words, sometimes before we could find the subject of the two opposites, we have to find the two opposites. So let's find the two opposites first before we actually get the subject. What's the two opposites that we're dealing with? It can't be poor and diligent. That's impossible. True. You're saying that one is honest and one is dishonest. That happens to be true. But the question is, why is the man poor? Or not all poor people are going to steal. So therefore, there must be something about this poor person that will make him steal, right? The question is, what is about this person that will make him steal? And I think the answer lies in the proverb itself. The person is poor by virtue of his laziness, that King Solomon is saying will lead to a false type of a fraudulent person or a crooked person. Is there, in other words, why isn't it possible that a lazy person could be honest? I understand I'm lazy, so I'm poor, but I might still have some integrity. Where does King Solomon say, where does he get that laziness is a cause to lose your integrity and to become crooked? What is the quality in laziness? Take a case, okay? You tell your child that they should go to school, get good marks. They need it, right? And the child is lazy about getting the marks. Okay? Now, what's the difference between you and the child? Is that you see the consequences and they don't. So what don't they have? They're lacking.
That's correct.
What they're lacking is truth, reality. They don't see the truth of reality. While you do. So the thing is, a person is lazy because he doesn't see the harm. He doesn't see the truth of the consequences of his actions. In other words, if your child would see a truck coming at him at 70 miles an hour, he would not be lazy. He'd move out of the way real fast. You see? So the thing is in other words, your child is not crazy. I mean, there are people that are, but I mean, the thing is that we're talking about a normal person that's lazy is because they don't see the benefit. They don't see in reality that anything is going to happen to them. They're losing out on truth. So therefore, it is true that sometimes a person is driven because of their emotions. Okay? But that is not what King Solomon is talking about. That's a different type of problem. And we have to wait for another verse to discuss these people that are just driven emotionally. But what King Solomon is defining as diligent and lazy, in other words, now we could define the subject. The subject is the lazy and diligent measures a person's relationship to reality. If he sees the truth about a certain situation, once he sees that there's no way he's not going to do it, if it's real to him, if that is just like a truck is coming at you, that's real to you, so then he has to do it. While the lazy person doesn't see that reality, and therefore he doesn't bother doing anything about it. Antidote to laziness is what?
Exactly.
Along with the analysis, there should be no questions left. If there's any question left, then that means there is still a problem and a further investigation is necessary. This is that the diligent are not always wealthy, and sometimes a lazy person is wealthy. Okay? So the question is that the statement is not totally universal. And with that, you have to understand the framework in which the book of Proverbs is written. The book of Proverbs cannot, if you're ignorant of what was going to happen on Mount St. Helens, and Mount St. Helens blew, and you were hurt, that's not your fault. It's out of your realm. There's no way of knowing. There is no way of knowing. So therefore, yes, we are not saying
that Proverbs will give you control of the laws of nature. Proverbs will not give you control over whole societies. I mean, this is run by governments. This is out of your hand. What Proverbs can undo is any mistake that you personally can make in any given situation. But even if you don't make any mistakes, that doesn't guarantee 100%, but it will guarantee 95%. In most situations, you will be successful. But however, there's sometimes things that are out of your hands, and there's nothing you can do about. Once you're in a situation that there's nothing you can do about, then you just have to accept these are the facts. There's nothing I can do about it. That also has to be analyzed when it's your fault and when it's not your fault. Question of the diligent, not all diligent, when we're talking about diligent, we're talking about a person that knows the life of Proverbs. He lives the life of Proverbs. If he is not successful and it's not due to him, that's not in the hands of Proverbs. That's different. That might be a different book in the Torah, how to deal with these things and how to relate to these things. But the book of Proverbs is only to undo your error in any given situation. Memory of the righteous. By the memory, I mean like when the righteous die and you remember them, like memory and memorial. Okay? So the memory of the righteous is for a blessing, and the name of the wicked will rot. Another proverb for homework. And the second proverb is, by the way, it's verse 11, this one in chapter 10. The source of life is the mouth of the righteous, and the mouth of the wicked conceals or hides violence. Okay, this week we're going over the proverb of the memory of the righteous is for blessing and the name of the wicked will rot. And the first thing that we'd like is some questions. What is a blessing, and to whom is the blessing? So it says the memory of the righteous is for a blessing, so who is the blessing for? Why by the righteous do they use memory, and by the wicked they use name, the memory of the righteous, and the name of the wicked? Why do they change from memory to name? And there are some questions which sometimes we might not have an answer to. I mean, it's possible we will get the answer to this. And the memory, difference between memory and name, it could be a literary difference, just to make it sound nice, not to have the same word, to repeat the same word. But the thing is that the main problem is we have to find the question that leads to the essential idea, you see? So that it's a guide. The question has to be a guide. Then all the other questions that we ask will either fall in place or we'll have to work out later. But we shouldn't sit down to answer each and every question. What we should try to search for is the essential idea, and that we need the question to guide us. The name of the wicked will rot. I mean, we know all the famous wicked people that have existed. We still know them. I mean, it's a fact. We know them. None of them rotted. The name is still remembered. How does a name rot? You know, a body rots, but a name doesn't. So, I mean, these things still exist. I mean, their names and the history of these people still exist. So what is he talking about? What does he mean? One aspect that we want to say is that we're talking about that it's after the death. Somehow we're talking about when the righteous die and the wicked die, somehow, that's the subject that we're talking about. Exactly how we're dealing with it, we're still not clear on that. I think, should we get involved in what is righteous and what is wicked? And the thing is, you have to let your question be your guide. Because the thing is that if the verse is not pointing to any information about righteous or wicked, so then you can accept your old definition of righteous or wicked, and you can't get anything from the verse, unless somehow the verse contradicts that. Or if you have a definition of righteous and wicked from another part of Proverbs, or even from another part of Torah, and you find that this verse contradicts it, so then the contradiction will help guide you to a concept. But if you really have no question to guide you, so then you have to accept the old definition of wicked and righteous, and because the verse will probably not help you in any way to guide you, unless there's a contradiction or some question to guide you. Two ways of, in other words, the verse is talking about the memory of the people, right? In other words, a righteous person or a wicked person. Now, the thing is, when you're talking about, you're looking back at what a person did or what a person didn't do, shouldn't we look at the actions of the people? In other words, they are righteous people. I mean, even the Torah sometimes mentions an area where one of the righteous people made an error, right? Made a mistake. So, and sometimes, what? Right? And sometimes a wicked person, you could learn something from a wicked person. Let's say, for instance, we would learn from Hitler about a strategy of war called the Blitzkrieg. Now, if I'm going to war just because Hitler created it, that doesn't mean I shouldn't use it. I mean, it would be if I was fighting a just war, and I needed this to win the war, then I would definitely use it. You see? In fact, they say by King David, when King Saul died in the war, it says King David taught his soldiers about shooting bows and arrows. Why? Because there was a new strategy of war that the enemy used against Saul, and somehow in shooting bows and arrows. There's something new. I don't have exactly. And immediately King David took that and taught his army that new strategy, which he took from the enemy. So therefore, I mean, there are things that you could learn from wicked and so-called strategy of certain sorts. Maybe you can't learn good and evil from them, you know, or you can know what not to do when you define evil. But the thing is you could, there's certain actions. And the question is, why does it relate to the person, right, instead of the actions? You should remember the righteous actions, and you should remember the wicked actions should rot. Should not rot altogether, because you should remember the actions of the wicked and see why it is evil, so to know what not to do. You should understand why is this considered evil. Once you understand why it's considered evil, then you know why not to do it. What you have to say is definitely talking about a righteous person and a wicked person. That's the verse is saying. Our question is it should have been talking about a righteous action and wicked action. I want to say that perhaps the verse is telling us that, like many times, we see things and we remember things in a better light than it actually was, and the proof of that is many times we go back to places that we remember with great fondness and we don't see it the same way when we come back. Remember, there were weaknesses there. Now, the question is, if that's what the verse is talking about, so then that would be a difficulty, because the verse should try to undo these false views. Because we're trying to find reality, and the mind plays tricks on us and makes us see the world incorrectly. So the verse should not be advocating this idea, But the verse should be trying to undo this type of idea, not advocating this idea. Now, Kim wanted to defend it by saying that, but still in all, it is a positive view of life, and therefore we should advocate a positive view of life. And if we have a therefore that's what King Solomon is advocating, a positive view of life. Trying to look at life in actual, not in a positive or negative way, but just to define actually what is reality. Okay? Say that maybe the verse is talking about that when a person looks at how people are going to look at them after life, you see, so then the way they look at them after life, so it will make her want to do the right to speak, so she should be remembered in a positive manner, while the wicked will not be remembered in a positive manner, and so therefore this would push a person to live the correct life. Altogether, what does a verse of Mishlei do? Does a verse of Mishlei tell us what does happen or what should happen? Okay? When it tells us what does happen, so that we should realize to be careful of what does happen. Or it tells us what to do. But the result of the verse must be something that I could deal with, that helps me deal with life. Sometimes dealing with life, you tell me a certain reality that I should do. Then sometimes you tell me a certain reality to be aware of the reality. That's also a lesson, so I should be able to deal with it. Just the knowledge of the reality. We'll have to see different verses, but different verses work in different ways. This is doing, that we'll have to see when we get through with the analysis. Possibility that was given for the interpretation of the verse was that a person will want to be good so that their name should be remembered after they die in a good life. Now the question is this a good motive for being good? Someone is interpreting the memory of the righteous is for blessing, by the word blessing, we mean that people will remember the righteous in a good light, in a nice light, so that they would want to be like the righteous and people will remember them. Blessing to the people that hear the stories of the righteous, the future generations. Blessing here in the verse is not for the future generation. It's talking about that the righteous will be remembered as a great thing, as a great benefit, as a good thing. That is what the word blessing means. Now that person was a blessing. That the person was a blessing, and then since he's remembered as a blessing and every human being wants to be remembered as a blessing, instead of just a feeling like a rot, so therefore this would be a motive for getting people to do the right thing. Is that a good motive for being righteous? The question is like this. What is the best motive for being righteous? Is the best motive for being righteous this motive? Because the people, so that you should have a good name, that you should be remembered by other people? Or is there inherently a benefit in being righteous? Now, we know that there's inherently a benefit in being righteous, and that's why you should be righteous. You see? So the question is, would they advocate that you should be righteous so that people will remember you as a righteous person? Person that decides to be righteous because he hears all the stories of the righteous and how nice people speak about them. And when they speak about the wicked, they speak in a very degrading way. So when he hears these stories, therefore he desires to be righteous. You see, that's what makes them want to be righteous. That the memory of the righteous is a blessing is people praise by blessing here, according to Kim's interpretation, then blessing over here means to praise the righteous. What is the benefit of praising the righteous after they're dead? And what is the benefit of making the names of the wicked look like rot? What is the benefit? So the benefit is for future generations, so that they should be remembered. They should be remembered as a... they want to be remembered as a righteous person after that. That's an emotional thing. It's like an ego thing. So that will be a motive to get future generations to do the right thing. You see? While when you degrade the wicked, so future generations don't want to identify with the wicked because everybody looks down on them. So therefore, that becomes the motive for a person to be good and to turn away from evil. Okay? But we ask the question, is that a good motive for being righteous? Isn't the reason that you should be righteous? Because inherently we could show that being righteous is a benefit for the human being. It's inherently a good. Not just for after I die, I'll be remembered by others. You see? But after they're dead, if I say that a righteous guy was a righteous guy, that doesn't benefit him anymore. He's dead. Right? So it can only benefit other people. Now, how could it benefit other people? Only by virtue of the fact that they'll want to identify with him, and that other people should praise them. That they should be praised by other people. Just like when they hear the righteous is being praised, so they're drawn to that thing which they will always be praised. So they'll also be praised. They want that praise. And that they will be praised after death. So therefore, you're saying that the verse is saying that this is a good reason for a person to be righteous. In other words, we advocate telling stories of the righteous and degrading the wicked for one purpose, so that future generations should be good. Now, all I'm asking on that is that a good motive for being good? Isn't the correct motive for being good when you see inherently that being righteous is a good? The benefit to your life, it perfects the soul. You see what it does for you. You see clearly what it does for you. Well, what is this idea about after death? We're learning the verse now. We're saying that the motive for a person to be good is that they should be praised like the righteous, and they won't be degraded like the wicked. And the question is that a good motive for being righteous? Is it definitely and resounding no? That's not a good reason. I mean, either we have to find a new interpretation or somehow straighten out this old one. That's just what we did here. When you have a verse that you don't understand, you first formulate the question. The question is your guide, and then as soon as we had the question, you started giving possibilities. Now, the natural mind grabs at the closest possibility. So therefore, but that first possibility that you grasp is not always the right one. So then we start questioning it and analyzing it to test it out if it's really a good interpretation. Now, if it doesn't work, so then once the mind sees that it's wrong, then that leaves room for the mind to search for something new. But if it doesn't see the contradiction, it doesn't see it's wrong, then why shouldn't the mind accept the answer that they have? What's wrong with it? There's no reason for it to continue on to look for anything new. There's no reason for it unless they see that there's something wrong. And that's what's happening in our discussion. What's happening is that once you see the question, then your mind naturally starts looking for the possibility. And once you start looking for the possibility, then you have to question and test out the possibilities through questions to see if it really works. And there's two types of tests. One, does it fit into the verse? Like, for instance, the last possibility definitely fits into the verse. But however, our question is, it doesn't fit into the philosophy of Torah. You see? So therefore, that can't be an interpretation of the verse. Except anything, because somebody else says it so. The only thing that you accept is the verse, because that's the postulate. That's what we're starting with. That's what we're analyzing. We accept the verse. But then once we go into the analysis, the possibilities, I mean, it must be clear to the mind that the interpretation is correct. It's It's not just an acceptance of authority or another person for being polite. It must be clear to the mind. If it's not clear to the mind, then formulate the question. That you have to understand that Mishlei, a proverb, is written for the beginner. Okay? And there's no way that when you're starting and studying, is that you could have the correct motive for study. There's no way that it's impossible. The correct motive for study only comes via study itself. Because if you study correctly, then that itself changes the motive why you do it. But when you start out, you must start out with an incorrect motive. You have no choice. I mean, it has to be, in other words, let's say, for instance, we say the correct motive is a love of learning. Now, a love of learning can only come after you've learned a certain amount of years. Let's say the correct motive is because you see the good and the good that there is in living this life, the benefit that there is in living. You can't see that for years, the benefit. By studying all the throughout the Proverbs and throughout other areas of Torah, you start seeing the benefit, and then it becomes part of you, where it affects your very being, that you have the true motive. And this book, Proverbs, was written for the beginner. So what we're saying is that Kim's answer is really correct. That really you should tell stories of the righteous and build them up and degrade the name of the wicked, so that people should desire to do the correct action for the incorrect motive and get involved in study of Torah for the incorrect motive. Because the study of Torah itself will bring you to the correct motive. But you must start out with an incorrect motive. And since this book, Proverbs, was written for the beginner, so therefore this verse becomes a true verse for the beginner. Saying that you should tell stories of the righteous and for blessing. When you tell the story, you should tell all their good points. Don't point out the weaknesses. And when you talk about the wicked, don't point out the good. Don't show them the difference in actions and define the different actions. But make it for, to talk to about them in a wonderful, the righteous in a wonderful light and the wicked in a bad light, so that people, for people, let's put it this way, you should talk about it for people that are not involved in study yet, and this would get them involved because they want to be remembered as a righteous, so that would be a good motive, even though it's an incorrect motive, but it's a good motive to get them started. Then if they really get started and they really start working hard, then their motive will change after a certain amount of time of study. Involved in the world of study, then you'll go back to these stories of the righteous and the wicked and analyze the individual actions and see why this action of the righteous is good and what's the benefit and why the action of the wicked is not good. Or what actions, or if there is an action that is good, what I could learn from and what I cannot learn from. But that's already a person that's a thinker that is not drawn by these ordinary, like the emotions of pride and what people think of me, you see. But the beginning, when we're motivated by these emotions, so then we have to draw people in for it based on these emotions. The object really of this verse is education. And we educate beginners through stories and allow them to identify or to break identification with the hero of the story. You see, either to identify with the righteous or to break the identification with the wicked. So therefore, the way we're learning the verse, the verse is a method of education for beginners. The subject is education, right? And when you educate a person, it's important to have them identify with a good education, with the heroes of the good education, so they should want to imitate them and continue in that way, and to have them turn away from the wicked, you see? until later on. Then you could analyze the actions and show why and where the all the whys and wherefores of an action. But to begin with, the beginning education is to attract the student towards the true life and the beneficial life, and to turn them away from the life of pleasure and the harmful things of life. Is that when you see a lot of people that advocate the good through stories, it never leads to a life of study. It remains in that situation. It doesn't change. You see? The thing is, what the Torah is saying, this is good for a beginner to start, but they should not stay. In other words, in most other cases, if they are advocating a just system, I'm not so sure those systems are really just. That we'll have to see according to more illustrations in Proverbs. But however, the thing is that it remains, the motive remains only to identify with the good person. They never explain logically why that is the good life. We say that's only for beginners. But for later on, then there's a different type of education. But for the beginner, the education is through, you should help them identify with the righteous and break their identification with the wicked. The subject is education for beginners. That we gave for homework last time was verse 11, and the proverb words, the source of life is the mouth of the righteous, and the mouth of the wicked conceals violence. The source of life. What is the source of life? The source of life is, we'll translate, the source of life is in the mouth of the righteous. That'll make it a little clearer. What does it mean in the mouth of the righteous? It's in the righteous habit. What is in the mouth of the righteous? Second half of the verse, that the mouth of the wicked conceals violence, yes. What I wanted to say was that we had that verse prior to this, which says, in the mouth of the wicked hide violence. So Doug wants to say over there, we said that's talking about secrets, so maybe we could start here by saying we're also talking about secrets. Is that if they speak right, if you're talking about in the mouth of that they actually speak about righteousness, then it can't be secrets anymore if the first half is talking about speaking and not about secrets. And that they keep secrets, he says, the mouth of the wicked conceals violence, means that they speak with forked tongue. In other words, they say one thing when they mean another. But the subject was secret. Okay? That is what we said last time. That the subject was secret. And that they said one thing, but they were hiding another. Okay? But over here, you're going to have two problems. One of the first doesn't seem to be, is in the mouth of the righteous, seems to be that he's talking. What he's talking, he says openly talking. Doesn't talk about like before. And two, if you can interpret it like the first verse, then what's the difference between the first verse and this verse? You mean they're both saying the exact same thing? They're dealing with the exact same subject? Why should he repeat himself? It was just a few verses back. We have that idea already about secrets. So why should he repeat himself? The same words, but however, it can't have the same meaning because it just doesn't fit in. That when it says the mouth of the wicked conceals violence, in that statement lies two possibilities. One is the main thing is the concealing, namely the secret, or the main thing is what he is saying. Now in the last verse, based on the subject of the last verse and interpretation of the last verse, he was saying the essence is concealing violence, and what he says covers that up. He hides it. But the thing is, it is possible that in this verse, there's going to be what the mouth of the wicked says is going to be the essence of the verse. In other words, the actual speaking might be the essence of the verse. I think that's where it's going. So that you understand, in other words, you can have the same words And I just want to show you that we are not changing around any of the words, or we're not playing any games with words. It's just, where is the essence lie? In other words, sometimes in the same statement, there are different aspects, and he's using different aspects in different verses, and the verse itself has to guide you. Is that clear? From the questions that we have in this verse, it's going to force us to interpret that both sides of this verse is talking something about speaking. And now when he conceals violence, we're going to have to understand how that fits into the speaking. Before, the speaking had to fit into the concealing of violence. Okay? But however, we're not changing any words. We're just using the words and interpreting them as according to the way it was set up, the way King Solomon set it up in the verse. To whom is the verse talking to? In other words, they're advising somebody. Who are they talking to? Because it says the source of life is in the mouth of the righteous. Now, to who is he speaking to? Is he speaking to the righteous? He knows the source of life. He spent years studying. So who are they telling this to, that the source of life is in the mouth of the righteous? They're talking again to beginners that wouldn't know this. Right? Okay. So we're talking to beginners, and we're telling them that the source of life is in the mouth of the righteous, and the mouth of the wicked conceals violence, and you shouldn't go to them. Which means that by nature I would make a mistake for some reason and go to the wicked. Okay? Now we have to ask, what do we mean by the source of life altogether? What is the source of life? Life, which everybody is guided by, is that there are certain basic principles, philosophies, that every human being really lives by a philosophy, whether they know it or not. For instance, let's say, for instance, you would steal stamps because you're not afraid of getting caught, but you wouldn't go to a bank and rob because you're afraid of getting caught, right? So therefore, you have a certain philosophy of life that really stealing isn't wrong, but the only thing is the preservation of getting caught, because the fear of getting caught. So your philosophy is the chance, you should only do it when the chance of getting caught is very little. That's your philosophy of life. But he's not saying that stealing is wrong. The whole stealing is okay. The only thing is that stealing is okay only if you're not going to get caught, so you don't take any chances. So everybody, even though a person does not think of it as a philosophy, but everybody is guided by a philosophy of life. That is the source of life. Source of life is your philosophy that you're guided by. Realizing that everybody lives by certain ideas, certain premises that they don't even realize, and that you have to start checking out to see what these premises are, to undo the false ones anyway, and to allow the good ones to take root. That's what we're trying to do now by working out the true ideas. Saying that they're guided by these ideas, but they didn't speak it out. They don't even know what it is. I agree, but I agree with that, and I'm not saying that's what the verse is talking about, but I'm just trying to show you that people live by philosophies that are irrational. Okay? Now, when you have an irrational philosophy, it means that the source of that philosophy is not based on reality. Now the question is, if it's not based on reality, then where does it come from? To come from is from within you. Now what people do is that when they have certain emotions and desires and psychological motives, what they do is some people lift those psychological and unconscious philosophies, is they formulate a verbal philosophy out of it. But the verbal philosophy, what they actually verbalize, or what they write about, if you listen very, very carefully, and you analyze it and question it, as we have been questioning the verses here, you will see that it will not be able to stand up to reality, because the reason is that they've made an emotion into a philosophy. Philosophy of might makes right.
right? Everybody wants to win. Well, you see, the people, they're competitive. They want to win, and so they're stronger, if they're faster. They're always, you see, that might mix right as a powerful emotion. Now, what people have done is they made it that emotion into a philosophy. The question is, can it stand up under questioning? Under analysis, will it stand up in the world, in the real world, in the world of ideas? I'm only trying to show you that everybody has a philosophy, and all these philosophies contradict each other. You know, some people hold that love, that's the whole thing, and other people hold that might makes right, and other people hold some other thing. How do you know which one is right? Everybody advocates. Well, some of them have to be wrong, and maybe they're all wrong. Maybe we don't have the right philosophy yet. But the only thing is, what I'm trying to say is, the false philosophies, where do they come from? They stem from within you. All your personal desires that you want to do, you put it in the form of a philosophy. This is telling the beginner. It says, if you have to find the tzaddik that will show you the true philosophy, because it's based on reality, a real analysis, a scientific analysis, where it stands up under all types of questions, where he himself has questioned his philosophy until he sees the truth. Just like we're analyzing to question these verses, after a while you start questioning things around you, when you train your mind to question. That'll be the test, to test out the different philosophies. You see? But for the beginner doesn't know this. So we have to warn the beginner that there's a lot of people that say very nice philosophies. That's what we're talking about, in the mouth of the wicked. They speak beautiful philosophies. But you have to be careful. The philosophy is the philosophy of their base emotions, their unconscious desires. You have to be very, very careful. It's not a real philosophy. It's a philosophy based on simply their emotions, where they lifted their emotions to the level of a philosophy. Congress people, right? Well, many times they put in terms of justice and what's right, because that's what the party line is. And it really, they just want to get their own personal advance in their own profession. So they say that which they think will advance them. But they don't say that to the public. They put it in terms of justice and righteousness, what's beneficial for the government. That's what people call politics. You see? So the thing is that people, what they do, people make a philosophy from their emotions. It's all violence because, first of all, it's violent because they're destroying, or if you have the wrong philosophy, so then you're being destroyed. And it comes from their base emotions. All base emotions are basically, evil. The base emotions are evil in the human. The human has to work it out through thought and through study and through understanding until they find a true philosophy. Now we're telling the beginner, what we're doing is telling the beginner that you have to be careful about who you learn your philosophy from until you learn how to really test it out and check it out. Just go to the righteous and learn philosophy. Don't go to the wicked to learn philosophy. Later on, once you know how to analyze and test things out, then you can go listen and start questioning them. You see? But the thing is you must recognize that anybody that does something, most of the times they give a philosophy why they're right. Sounds very smooth. But if it's an irrational philosophy, you should know it's only to conceal they're really a desire to satisfy their base emotions, and they're lifting their base emotions up to the level of a philosophy. But it's not philosophy. The way we understand philosophy is it's simply to recognize what is real. The only way you could test what is real is the way we analyze a verse here. We question it and analyze it until we can put it together until it makes total sense. But the thing is that the wicked is they speak to the emotions and you're drawn in, and your conscious mind doesn't question. On the contrary, if you did question, they'd get very upset with you. A person's philosophy is really basically his emotions. When you start questioning him and showing him that, hey, just for a minute, this doesn't sound right, and they get very angry. A person should want to analyze their philosophy to check it out to see if it's really correct. Why are you getting angry? You see?
Well, and
means the base emotions, the unconscious emotions of the human being. It's basically a violent place. Okay? I don't want to get into the area of where it stems from, how it works. But the thing is, all I am saying is the basic, the Torah says that a person is born wild, meaning that the base instincts of the human being is more animalistic, wild, and you know, you see all the base emotions when people live according to their base emotions and just let go, which usually leads to violence or promiscuous sex. So the thing is, it's just wild things. So the thing is, what people do is lift this thing to a whole philosophy of life. And they say it's right because they're justified with a philosophy of life. You see? And that's what you have to be careful of. Who does not know how to protect himself from false philosophies should go to the righteous and learn how to think, should get the right philosophy, and also be trained how to think so that he could test out the incorrect philosophies. You see, then you can listen to these people, to the righteous. I mean, to the wicked. You can listen to the wicked, and but analyze it. But before your mind is ready to analyze, you should be very, very careful. You should at least know that the truth is in the mouth of the righteous, and the true philosophy of life that will most benefit you in this world is in the mouth of the righteous, and not in the mouth of the wicked. And you can see that for yourself. In time, when you've learned to question and how to analyze and to test things out. How does a beginner know the difference between the righteous and the wicked? How can he doesn't know? He could be fooled. I haven't figured that out yet, how the beginner does that. I don't know. There must be a way. But I don't know it yet. What we ask now in this verse is, what is the subject of the verse? Okay? The comment was made that but the discussion got so far from the verse that suddenly, where's the verse come in? The answer is that you're right. Sometimes the discussion moves along to get clarity in a certain area, and you lose sight of the verse. But however, and when in the final analysis, you should always come back to the verse and say, now, after all this discussion, after everything is said and done, what does the verse mean? And does it fit into the words? Life, according to Torah, is always ideas. So the source of life is definitely ideas. Okay? That's the source of life. Okay? Now, the true ideas means that you're explaining what is reality, and you try to get your life in line with that reality. While the wicked, what they do is they make a philosophy out of their emotions. It has nothing to do with reality. They look at reality through their emotions, and they make a philosophy on their feelings, how they feel about life. Then they verbalize it and put it and make it into a philosophy. That is the wicked, okay? Since the source of life means a philosophy, and the true source of life is in the mouth of the righteous, then the mouth of the wicked must mean their philosophy. Now, where does their philosophy come from? It comes from their wickedness, namely their unconscious violence or desires, their unconscious desires, and it's represented by violence. But it means their base emotions, what they want to live, so they build a whole philosophy out of it to make it the correct thing. The source of life is the correct way of living. Okay? I must see that people are guided by philosophies. But there are two sources. See, the source of life means that it's really based on an idea. Any person that lives a certain type of life, or they do certain things, you see, you could always, by their actions, you could define what their philosophy of life is. You see? So therefore, there's two sources to philosophy. Either it's based on reality, that's the real source of life, that's in the mouth of the righteous. But the mouth of the wicked, their philosophy stems from their base emotions. That's what it means, conceals violence, because the violence is in their base emotions. Then they make a whole philosophy out of that. Right. Might doesn't make right, but they make a whole philosophy out of their desire to use violence to be successful and to control other people, so they write a whole philosophy about it. The verse is saying, it's telling the beginner that every life, every action, and every way of life that a person lives is based on ideas. It's based on ideas. What you base your life on, the ideas that you base your life on, that we call a philosophy. That is philosophy of life. Okay? And what we're saying is that you have to be very, very careful. There's certain philosophies that are based on reality that the mind could see and test out scientifically that it is true. And there's certain philosophies that are based totally on their emotions, but they put it in a philosophy of life. You see? So the subject matter is philosophy. The philosophy of life, or a way of life. Or like the verse says, the source of life. But whatever it is, it's an idea. Now there are two ways you could formulate your philosophy. You could formulate it based on reality and a true search for reality, like we analyze every single part of the verse and question it. Or it's just that you have certain feelings that you want to live a certain life. So you don't say, well, I feel like murdering people. What you do is you make a philosophy out of it, like might makes right, or some other type of philosophy like that. You see? So you make a philosophy based on your emotions. So what the pasuk is saying, what the verse is saying, is that you have to be very, very careful, since every lifestyle is based on a philosophy. You must be very careful of these different philosophies, especially when people advocate, and they're good speakers, and they can advocate a certain philosophy, hey, that sounds right. But it's not right until you've tested it out, exactly the way you're being trained to question these verses. And that will train you to question and to test out the different philosophies to see if they can be acceptable or not. I want to say that based on this idea, that we can now have a definition of righteous and wicked. I want to say that righteous is a person that guides his life by a reality. This reality is tested out through scientific method until it's shown that it is 100% correct. While the wicked is a person that lifts his base emotions to the level of a philosophy. That is what the wicked are. Chapter 10, verse 12, that hatred awakens arguments or quarrels, and love covers all faults. What is hatred? What is love? And what is the relationship? Are they opposites, hatred and love, or what are they? Is how does hatred stir, awaken quarrels or starts quarrels, and how does love cover transgressions or faults? Okay. Is the verse talking about hatred and love as an emotional phenomenon, or is it some type of a logical phenomenon? Another thing, which side, usually they have which is the good side and which is the bad side, you know, which is evil and which is good. Here they don't mention which is evil and which is good, they just mention the love and hate, and they don't help us out too much. Let's take up what is hate, okay? What do we mean by hate, okay? Let's say, for instance, somebody does me harm, okay? Now the question is, how do I deal with it? I have to deal with it in a very, very practical manner. There are one or two possibilities. Either I can protect myself or I can't protect myself. That's all. If I cannot protect myself, then I have to accept the reality. That's it. There's nothing I can do. If I can't protect myself, then I should protect myself. I should protect myself. I have a right and an obligation to protect myself from any transgression that somebody has against me. But however, that is not the usual way, the way people relate. What happens is that within them, they have a tremendous amount of anger. And the situation allows the anger its expression. In other words, hate is anger waiting for the right situation to explode in. So it's always looking for that. Hate is always looking for an argument. That's what the verse is saying. And it just needs the right situation, and it doesn't take much to open up the floodgates and let it just all pour out. Like you said before, it's in terms of vengeance and harming others and in gossiping about others and looking at fault. It's just a matter of the right situation to bring it out. That's hatred. Has a certain amount of hatred and aggression within them, and it's always there. It is there in everybody. It's a normal human trait. Love, really, you have to be careful here that most love is a fear of looking at your own hatred. In other words, it's really not a positive. It's really a negative. In other words, like this. Those people that are look at everybody in a good light, everybody is good, is because they don't want to see their own hatred. And the way they cover their own hatred is they cover it in everybody. I'll soon give you another illustration. Excuse me, just let me finish. And the thing is that that's one type. Then also, for instance, when a person falls in love, right, so there's a strong identification, so you don't want to see their problems either, because it'd be like seeing your own problems, you see? And then at the time of the Holocaust, people did not believe what the Nazis were doing, you see? I think is that people did not want to believe that such a thing is possible in human nature. Because once it's possible in human nature, then it's possible for me to be like that too. And that's why they denied even the possibility of such a thing. Negative, it's not that it's negative. I'm not saying it's negative. I'm saying, but its purpose is to protect yourself to a large extent from seeing the evil within you. You see? People look at it as a positive, like an objective thing is love. It's an emotional thing. And you have to put it in terms of the emotions. And the emotions are simply that its purpose is to make sure that you don't see evil, either in everybody or in certain people that you identify with. So you don't want to see evil in them. The person feels for another person is because they identify with them. There's a certain identification with them. Okay? Now, just like in yourself that you hide faults within yourself, in other words, you don't want to see your own faults, so because you identify with somebody, so you don't see their faults either. Whoever you'll identify with, so therefore you will not see their faults. In that way, I mean, in other words, love is really some type of identification. You see, that you identify with this person on a very strong emotional level. You see? But however, but just like when you identify with somebody, you will cover, just like on yourself, you try to hide from yourself your own faults, so you will hide it from others. You will hide the faults of the person that you identify with. One thing, there is a love that comes as a result of knowledge. Maimonides, at the end of his Guide for the Perplexed, which is a very abstract philosophical book, he says, at this point you'll truly love people. Okay? In other words, there's a certain love that comes as a result of your knowledge of God. Mm-hmm. It's a very high level. But the emotions fall in line with your ideas. And that love is a true love of a person. The love that we were talking about in the verse is a love that everybody is born with, that everybody has. When they have that love, that's the nature of love. But there is a love that comes, it's a certain feeling that comes as a result of a very high level of knowledge of God. When you have that knowledge of God, then you relate to people emotionally via God, and so therefore you have a love of people via... I can't go into detail exactly how it works. It's a little difficult, and it's very far from the verse. But I just want you to know that it's not that we do not hold from love. It is love, but love is the love that we advocate is a result of your knowledge of Torah. Original love that a person feels must come through identification. And since you identify with the person, so therefore, just like you're going to cover, you hide your own faults, even from yourself, people hide their own faults from themselves, so will you try to cover from yourself the faults of somebody you are in love with. Question, what is the subject of the verse, right? What is the subject? Be hatred or love. Hatred and love are opposites, okay? They're two opposites of the spectrum. Hatred comes from total lack of identification. I have all this anger within me ready to come out. While love comes from a cover up of the anger, right? So the two opposites, okay? Now the question is, since they're two opposites, they must be opposites in something. Every opposite must be an opposite in something. So if it's an opposite in something, the question is, what is it an opposite? First, you have to understand there are two ways of relating to other people. One is rational and one is emotional. Rational, I relate very practically, like we started off in saying, the practical thing, somebody does me harm or somebody's going to harm me, then I just analyze the best way to protect myself and I have the right to do that. And I protect myself in the best possible way. Okay? That's practical. It has nothing to do with my emotions, how I feel about the person. But however, the emotional way of relating to people is one of two ways. Either I'm looking for a fight, or I'm looking to cover up faults just to get out of a fight. Somebody said, well, I don't feel these ideas. I mean, I don't feel what you're saying. And the truth is that when you start on a rational approach to life, you're going to find that most of the ideas are not in line with your emotions. And all you could be happy at the beginning is that your mind sees it, and that you try to live according to it as best as you can. But then as you continue in all your studies and thought and training your mind to think, then after a while your emotions will come in line with your ideas. Okay? So you can't expect when you see an idea like this to say, well, yeah, I feel that way. No, we don't feel that way. We definitely don't. And it takes a long time for it to become real to us, an idea like this. And I'm saying, but it does kind of take time until you, through going over the different, not only this idea, but as you get into more and more ideas and you see things rationally, then that in itself, just the idea, just that it's clear to the mind, will affect your emotions. I would advise you to, if you have the ability to think about one idea, I would say that's the best thing, because the thing is when you think about an idea, but not just to think about it, but to see if you could find questions, let it roll around in your mind, try to look at it from different angles, see even if you could find questions, and through the analysis and through the training and through the thinking about it, slowly but surely through the years, that type of clear thinking, as it becomes clear to the mind, then that affects the emotions. It's not the quantity of ideas that bring you close to God, it's the quality of the ideas of how clear it is to your mind, and then how much it affects your emotions. How much it affects your emotions is a barometer of how real the ideas are to you. Because of the questions that are being asked, I would like to explain one thing, and that is, according to Torah, a human being is born wild. What I mean by wild is his basic nature is evil, okay? And the thing is, the only way to straighten that nature out is through knowledge, through the knowledge of Torah and through guidance, so that you find the truth. And through the truth, the human being is different than any other animal in the world. Any other animal was created that its basic nature is to protect itself, and to protect at least the species. The human being's emotions are basically to destroy itself. And if you look around you, you will see that we're destroying ourselves. Okay? So the thing is, the only way to get away from this is to undo, through rationale, let's put it this way, to be guided by rationale how to live your life. And that is the basic foundation of Proverbs, is to give you the basic foundation of how to guide your life on a rational basis. One of the problems that a person has is that we're using good and evil, and a person has his own view of good and evil. And because of that, when he hears these ideas, so he gets confused because of his old ideas of good and evil. And from what we're saying now, somehow it does not fit in with that. So the best working definition that we can deal with here is that, just say that evil is ignorance. Evil is ignorance. We're not going to deal, of course there's a lot of emotions that tell us what to do, but basically evil is ignorance, and you need the Torah to teach you the correct way of looking at it. And when you see it in the Torah light, then you will see the reason why we say that evil is ignorance, because you'll see that it's just a lack of knowledge about the world that you could actually see in the world, and you'll see it from these verses. Evil of the emotions start from infancy, from the way you're trained. You see, so you get within you. You have a view of good and evil, but that idea of good and evil is an infantile view. So you do have an idea, a vague idea of good and evil. What you have to do is straighten that idea of good and evil out with the knowledge of Torah. verse 13, and it says, "The lips of the thinker, in the lips of the thinker, you will find wisdom, and a stick to the back, fool." But literally, it's lacks wisdom. Okay, thinker, you will find wisdom, and a stick to the back of a fool, or a person who lacks wisdom, lacks knowledge. Okay. Now, we're going to analyze this verse in two ways. Okay? We're going to have two different verses. Okay? Two different proverbs. One is, in the lips of the thinker, comma, you will find wisdom, comma, and a stick to the back of a fool. The second way is, in the lips of a thinker, you will find wisdom, comma, and a stick to the back of a fool. We said that in the lips of a navon, of a wise person, comma, you will find wisdom and a stick to the back of a fool, or literally a person that lacks any type of knowledge. Questions? Who's a thinker? Okay. We are not. This verse will not define a thinker, so we will not try to define it. We'll have to wait for a verse that clearly defines what a thinker is, you see, so then we will deal with thinking. But the question is a good one, but we'll have to keep that question and wait for a verse that deals with a thinker. Stick to the back of a fool means? First, where there's a comma after the words, the lips of a wise person or intelligent person. The problem is that when a thinker talks, and he talks wisdom, right? So some people will find wisdom in it, and to some people that statement will be like a stick to his back, okay? Now, stick to his back certainly does not mean literally. When a person says, as a person is only speaking, you can't say stick literally, you see? So it must be that the stick to the lips, stick to the back must be a metaphor, okay, representing some type, something, whatever it represents. But it is when there's certain people, when they listen to the lips of an intelligent person, to a wise person, to a person that's giving, like, knowledge of proverbs, right? So the thing is to some people, that knowledge is like a stick to his back. Metaphor, that's the first problem that we have to deal with. The reality is that a stick to the back is, one, is a punishment, possibility that it's a punishment, or two, that it is a way of goading him, to get him going, to goad him on, okay? Now, the thing is that, see, all we know is, sifse navon, the lips of a wise person speaks intelligence, you see? So, therefore, we're not talking about where he's talking to the fool, like, lecturing the fool or telling the fool to be good. He is talking wisdom. Therefore, certain people will find wisdom in it. See, if it's a stick to his back means punishment, you see, then it would not apply to the first half that he would find wisdom in it. Because if it's a punishment, the guy that accepts wisdom doesn't need a punishment. So therefore, the very words that one person will find wisdom, truth, that very words will be a stick to the back of a fool. The problem, how would it be a stick? How is the words a stick? If it's a punishment, he's telling them off, or he's goading them on, whatever it is, so then I understand, it's painful. But if the very same words is wisdom to one person, how could those, you're just listening to a lecture and ideas, truth. How could those very words be, the very same words, will be a stick to the back of? It's the lips of the wise person, that's like a speaker. Right. Now, in the group that is listening to it, right, to him, there will be some that will find wisdom, and there will be some that'll be a stick to their back.
Right.
You see? Those are the listeners, okay? So there's two types of people, how they relate, just to wisdom. Not to rebuke, to wisdom. To
to ideas, to truth. The rod, the words become a rod to beat somebody on the, as if it was beating him on the back, to certain people when they hear this wisdom. The question is why? In the verse, in this verse, is really how people relate to truth. Okay? Truth or reality. Okay? There's two ways of relating to truth. One way is I see it for what it is. Like, let's say, for instance, you know that if you come to a street corner, you have to stop and look both ways. You see? A child, when he comes to street corner and looks both ways, it's because he's obeying his parents. You see? And to him, he's only answering to authority. And he doesn't want to relate to authority. You see? So to a lot of people, truth is simply an authority. You see? That's one way of looking at it. Truth, reality, many times interferes with our life. You see? And the thing is that's why people have ways of dealing with reality in very funny ways. They keep changing it around. Because it interferes. You see? So they keep changing it around. And this reality becomes really an authority. You see? That you don't want to accept. You don't want to accept this reality. It's like a demand because your mind doesn't see it. And your emotions are going in a very different way, in a very different place, you see? So, therefore, when reality comes in, it's like you want to go one way, and the authority is telling you to go the other way. See, to a person that's the first half, the first person, when he hears reality, it might run against his emotions, but he sees it as reality. When we tell you have to live a certain type of life and we show you clearly every step, you say, yeah, I have to do it, but I don't like it, but I have to do it. I see it. But to the other person, to the second half, to the fool, he really doesn't see the truth. So therefore, when reality hits him, he looks at it as some authority forcing him to do something. You see? So when the intelligent person gets up and goes step by step and says, this is truth, this is reality, and it affects his life, he just looks at the person as some authority telling me what to do. You see, he looks at that person as just telling me something what to do. You see? So therefore, he looks at him just as an authority, not a reality. Once you look at somebody as an authority, and the authority is forcing you to do something, so then it's like a stick to your back. It's like he's forcing you.
Well, then why?
Do not know the harm of the reality, why they have to look both ways and why they can't walk in the street. When they stop, it's because they're obeying their parents. It's they want to go on, they want to run free, but their parents stop them, they'll get punished. So therefore they stop. Now anybody that has to stop because they're just going to be punished can't be very happy with it, you see. So therefore when the wise person tells over wisdom, and that wisdom affects the way you look at life, or that wisdom affects the way you're going to act in life, or the way you're going to deal in life, it affects you. Since you don't, if you see it as wisdom, so then then you accept it. It might be difficult, but you accept it. But if you don't see the ideas and you don't accept it as wisdom, then you only accept it as an authority telling you what to do.
Is it possible?
Authority, you want to do one thing and the authority is telling you to do the other. Some people look at reality in a wrong way. They'll tell you, the whole philosophies are built on wrong philosophies. Why? Because they want to look at life in a certain way and they don't let reality interfere with their views of life. You see? They just want to look at life in a certain way and reality is only an interference. Just to stop them, so they have to deny reality somehow. Now the same thing, if it's a person that's telling you, how much more so, oh boy, forget it, who wants to listen to him? Becomes an authority telling me what to do. The intelligent person, what he's telling you to do, now if you don't listen to him, then you are not acting in line with reality. You see? So reality itself you don't accept. You don't accept reality because you don't act in line with it. So you're not accepting reality. Now, when you, so it's going to have to interfere at some point. So therefore, you ever see a kid, he runs into a table, and he gets angry with the table, like the table did something. You see, he looks at reality as something interfering. He's angry with it. Why do you interfere with me? Why do you hurt me? You see? So he blames the authority. That's the authority stopping him. Causes pain. You see? So the thing is the same thing. That's the fool. The fool is, he may be an adult, but insofar as the ideas of Proverbs, which are more abstract, he relates to the world in that same infantile manner. The world just gets in his way. You know what I mean? When you start out, you accept that sage as an authority. But however, after you study them and you start understanding, it becomes clear to the mind, then you say, look, they're explaining what reality is, and now that I see it, so I'm just going to do it. You see? Nanathadi, it was Bachi Ibn Pakuda, the author of Duties of the Heart, gives an illustration, an illustration for a different purpose, but it might help us. He says, if you're in a room, dark room, blackout, and you are not familiar with it, whichever which way you walk, you're going to bang into it. You're going to bang into furniture because you're not familiar. But if they would give you a little flashlight, and you put that on, you would never bump into anything. You see? Now the thing is, people relate to reality in the same way. Since they do not have the knowledge of Proverbs, or the knowledge of Torah, all areas of Torah, so they relate to life in an incorrect manner. And so therefore they keep banging themselves and getting banged all over, and they keep denying it. And they keep going on. They live with their own philosophy. But if they put on a light, which means that they had the truth, their mind would see the truth. That's right? Their mind would see the truth, so then immediately they would bang into anything. They'd have to do what is correct. That the verse is talking about a wise person that's speaking. I've also attached it, this verse, also to the idea how people relate to reality itself. See, because the words of the wise person is reality. So, but when there's a wise person, they attach it to the person. But also people, when it comes to reality, they can't take reality. So what they do is they change their opinion of reality. They have a whole different philosophy to change around reality. But it's the same, the reason is the same reason, because truth and reality is just a big pain in the neck to them. It's just like a big stick hitting them in the neck. It just stops them from doing everything they truly desire to do and want to do. They have desires for one thing, and truth tells them if you live that way, you're going to hurt yourself. And they don't want to hear that. They don't want reality interfering with their life. That is that the lips of a wise in the lips of a wise person you can't find wisdom, period. And then the stick, and they stick to the back of a fool. Okay? Subject to the verse. What does one side have to do with the other? You understand, right? That's the main question. Objective, I believe, is to get a person to do an act. To do an act. If you want an intelligent person to do an act, speak to him and tell him why. Explain to him why he should do the act. And then he will do the act. You see? There's some people, the only way you can get him to do an act is by giving him a stick to his back, literally. Force him. That's the only way. Pressure. He could take a certain amount of pain, and that's it. And once you get, in other words, you can either talk, a person will do the correct act in one of two ways. Either you talk to him correctly and show him rationally why you should do the correct act. That's one type of person. Right? And a wise person, right? And unless a wise person, you'll find wisdom. Meaning that will cause you to do an act. The other type of person, the only way to get him to do an act is not with your lips, but with a stick. You see, the first half is the lips of a wise person will get you to do, you will find wisdom. You will get him to do an act. You will get him to do the correct act. But however, in the second way, the only thing that will get him to do an act is the stick. But, where do I see that in the first half of the verse? Okay? The thing is that it's true that if I just had the first half of the verse by itself, okay, it would say the lips of a wise person you will find wisdom, right? Okay? That can mean many things. Definitely, I wouldn't think of that it means to get me to do an act. Okay? But however, because I have the second half and I don't know how they fit in, there is only one way that I see that these two things can fit in. In the lips of a wise person, you will find wisdom to do the correct act. And that correct act, you see, if you want somebody else that is not wise to do the correct act, then you must force him. That's a stick to his back, to the fool, who cannot accept that. In other words, the first half of the verse does not exclude what I'm saying. It is a possibility. Now, you're saying there might be other possibilities. You are correct, if you only had the first half. But since I have the second half with the first half, so therefore I accept this possibility. The first half is broad, but the second half forces me to narrow it down. Okay? If the subject is to get somebody to do an act, there's two ways of getting people to do an act. One is through wisdom, and one is through force. The definition of discipline is simply how much pain could the student take or the child take before they do the correct act. That's all it is. Correctly, yes, you would have to be a wise person, but it wouldn't be from his lips. It will have to cause some type of punishment. But there are a lot of people that punish that don't know how to punish, and they get very bad results. Sometimes it's better if they didn't. They'd be better off. You have to know how to punish, when to punish, when it's going to backfire, and it's going to be worse than what you started out with. So you really have to know how to use a stick. Who should use a stick should also be a wise person. As an illustration, for the person that you have to hit before he gives does the act, he gives an illustration of Pharaoh, Paro. See, because he would not send the Jews out simply because God asked, and they proved to him that there was a God, and the proofs he wouldn't take. So since he wouldn't take the proofs, so God hit him with the plagues. It was only after the plagues that they got him to get going. So Rashi has that as an illustration of the second half of the verse. Treating the person that's a fool more like an animal. It's true. An animal will operate totally on pain. And the same thing with the human. He has a animal part of him, and he will get away from, at a certain point, the pain will force him to do the correct act. It has nothing to do with wisdom. When he's doing the correct act, it's only because of pain, just like an animal. There is no wisdom there. Wisdom should be, discipline should really only come through wisdom, as much as possible. Like when you train a child to cross the street, you should not tell him don't cross or we'll punish you. You should explain to him that crossing is a dangerous thing. Show him the reality. You see? If at all possible. But of course, if he won't listen, you don't want the kid to get hurt. So therefore, you have to put on force if he's not going to listen. You see? The point was is that in a society also, society can only be run through punishment. We can't wait for a murderer to stop the train and think him, and in 20 years maybe he'll become good, maybe he'll start thinking, and he'll stop murdering. The thing is, we have to have punishments, and therefore laws in a society is also a very practical thing to stop people from doing the correct act. If we cause them pain, so then they'll stop doing the incorrect act. Okay? But however, when a person does the correct act because he's afraid of punishment, that is not a perfected human being. What we mean by a perfected soul is we mean a person that does the correct act because his mind sees that this is the best way of living. That this is the rational, he sees it with his mind from step one to step 10. Straight down the line, he sees it clearly. That it is the correct way. And when you live according to your mind, that is the perfected soul. The 15. The wealth of a rich man is his strong city, comma. The destruction of the poor is their poverty. The wealth of a rich man is his strong city. The destruction of the poor is their poverty. Yes, you're right. Poverty is the cause, and the destruction is the result. Take the verse literally, where wealth means money. Okay? Yeah, we're not going to take it metaphorically. We're going to take it literally, that it means money. What is a strong city? City, we mean that it protects him. That money is a certain type of protection. That's what the verse is saying. Poor means that since they don't have any money, so if something goes wrong, they can't help themselves. They can't deal with it. Something goes wrong with my car, so a rich man will say, well, I'll go out and buy a new car, or I'll have it fixed. The poor man, before he can have it fixed, has to start worrying, where is he going to get the money from? So the rich man is protected by his wealth. This is that rich over here is singular in the Hebrew, and poor is plural. So the third question is why. I would say offhand because it's talking about probability. There's very few people that are rich. There's more people that are poor. Just talking about how things usually do occur. The question that we have to ask, and this verse is contrary to the whole philosophy of Proverbs. Because Proverbs says the only real protection in this world, the only way to be successful in this world is wisdom. And he constantly proves throughout that money is no real protection unless you have wisdom how to use it. But without wisdom, the wealthy man can destroy himself too. And his money won't be a protection for him. First, King Solomon is going against his basic philosophy in all that he writes in all of Proverbs. That all of Proverbs is the basis for to have the physical world is wisdom. And those people that are lacking in wisdom, or they have wisdom, but they have certain emotions that affect their thinking process, at that point they're going to fail. And now suddenly he says, wealth is a protection. What I have to say is, we're using a fortified city as an allegory. So the thing is that when a person is in a protected city, even if he's not wise, that situation is a good situation. It's true in the long run he'll fail, but what King Solomon is saying, he's observing the physical world, and he's saying there are certain things, there are certain situations where having money is beneficial, where having certain protection is beneficial even without wisdom. It's true the wise person will be successful whether he has this or not, he'll work it out, you see. But practically in the physical world, there are, without wisdom, certain situations that are better than other. Like, for instance, if you have money, like we said before, practically, there are many things you could do. If your car breaks down, you don't have to worry. You just buy a new car. You just have it fixed. You see? If you have a fortified city, so you will be protected that situation. Of course, if the enemy happens to have a certain amount of knowledge, then they will work out a way of breaking down the fortified city. But giving equal, you know, having a fortified city on one side and the enemy on the other, that is a certain situation that, given just the facts of the situation, that situation is a better situation than a non-fortified city. You see? So therefore, the thing is that all he is saying is when you look around the world, you will see that there are situations which are better than others. That's all he's saying. That's a fact of life. But he's not saying that that is better than wisdom. He's not saying money is better than wisdom. But he says money has a certain advantage. Having a fortified city has a certain advantage over a non-fortified city. So the thing is that there are certain situations which, by definition, is just a better, it's a better situation. But people have had very good situations and destroyed it because they didn't have the wisdom. They didn't know how to deal with it. You see? So therefore, his subject, what he's dealing with, is simply physical world without wisdom. That's it. There are situations which are better than others. That's all he's saying. To be rich and healthy than poor and sick. That's true. In general, is why is it that, like, one verse has nothing to do with the other verse, and he seems to be jumping from one subject to another subject, and one has nothing to do with the other. The answer is, in my opinion, is that this book was written for beginners. And a beginner it's very difficult to take a whole subject all at once. So therefore, that's why he made it into Proverbs. Proverb is one sentence with all the information and one aspect of a very large subject. You see? It's a large subject, or this area, and this could be worked out in a logical form. But he took a different verses, and each one is a different idea, so that the beginner can handle and deal with very simple ideas and a very few facts, so that the beginner can develop his mind that way and start developing that way. Later on, he should take the whole subject of ethics. That would be like in the chapter of the fathers. It's there. It's written categorically, you know, what you need. It doesn't go in this much detail as in Proverbs. Because I think Proverbs was written for beginners. Therefore, there is no connection between one verse and the other. As in verse 16, and the verse is like this. The actions of the righteous are for life. And the results, or the product, of the wicked is for sin. What he means by sin, we're doing verse 16. The action of the righteous is for life, and the product or the results of the wicked are for sin. Meaning sin here means failure or destruction. What is the activity of the righteous? What do righteous people do? What is the activity? The product, or what is the end result of the wicked? Making a comparison between the first half and the second half, the problem is, why does it speak about the actions of the righteous and the results of the wicked? Either let's deal with results or deal with actions. Why is it change in the middle? The actions of the righteous is for life. The question is it talking about the quality of life? Or is it talking about the longevity of life? How does the actions of the tzaddik relate to the life? Or whatever life means, we're not sure yet. But however, we're going to have a relationship between his actions and life. The product lead to failure. Okay? Is the action of the righteous, is it his intention for life? Result in life. Okay. I'll answer this question first, because this is the basic premise of Proverbs, okay? The basic premise of Proverbs is, let's say, for instance, there is a scientist. There was an experiment. The first experiment was people tried religion to change the world, to get their effects, right? They brought sacrifices, and they brought human sacrifices, and they gave gold to the gods and all these things. Of course, this experiment did not work. Later, the scientists came and analyzed the nature of the physical world, and then based on that, they did get their results. In other words, we have cars today, and we have conveniences, and we have better medicine today, and better cures, and all these things, the modern things that we have, the benefits of modern-day life, is because there was an investigation into the nature of the physical world. Okay? Now, the thing is that to be successful, when you analyze what is important, how to get to the physical world, there's two parts. There's the physical world, and then there's the human being, the nature of the human being. Now, the problem with the human being, he makes mistakes because he has a side of him that he makes decisions based on his emotions, like greed and jealousy and stingy and greed, all these things. So the thing is that because of these decisions, so he's making a decision not in line with reality. Just like when a person worshiped these gods, so it's not in line with reality, it couldn't work. You see? So we say that if you're in line with reality, you will be successful, except in one area, where it's beyond your control. Okay? With totally out of your control, or a possibility that's impossible for you to think of. But however, there will be, if you train your mind to think correctly, and if you undo all your emotions, then you will not make any mistakes. Because the only mistakes is made by the incorrect decisions of the emotions. You see?
So therefore, the thing that I mean, for that to happen, I mean, it's practically, I mean, you know, is a you know what I mean? Like a rare. There's a few people that made it. It seems like Jacob made it. Like when he went down to Egypt, he was 127. Okay, so he's on the level of Jacob, and at 127, he undid his last emotion. Okay, but the thing is it's a rarity. But the only thing is, as we get closer to that, the chance of us making mistakes become less and less as we remove these possibilities. So therefore, when we say that his actions is to life, we don't mean his intent. We mean that if he lives correctly, then he will be totally successful. You see? Whether this verse in particular is talking about that at this point, I really don't know. It's possible that's the purpose of the verse. You see? But however, insofar as that question in general, that's the way we look at life. Interpretation of the verse. I would say that is what the verse is talking about. In other words, the actions of the righteous is for life because his actions are in line with reality. By life means he will be successful. He will have the good life. Okay? And the results of the wicked are for failure because he's not living in line with reality. And that's really the basis of the book of Proverbs. For instance, a person wants to make a plan, or he's discussing what he should do, what college he should go to, or any type of thing that has to do with the future, right? Now, the only way to do it is, let's say, for instance, you would discuss it with somebody, and that person would ask you different questions. See, a question shows that the idea is not complete. Now, once you answer every single question from every different angle, you see, so then it says, well, according to rationale, that makes sense. Therefore, that is in line with reality. That is what we mean in line with reality. We sort out exactly the way we work on a verse. We ask all our questions, and then we see if all our questions are answered. Then we know that it's true, and that way you will be successful. That's how we know it's in line with reality. The only test, the Meiri medieval commentary says that the only test for truth. It's questions. It's every single question. When you have the result, and the result answers every single question, that's how you know you have the truth. You see? Now, once you do that, then you do it. If something goes wrong, then there's two possibilities. One is if it was something totally out of your ability to get the information, or to be aware of. So you didn't know to plan for that. Or you made a mistake, and there's one area that you didn't analyze that you could have analyzed, and therefore you failed. Those are the two possibilities if you fail. So whether life means longevity or whether it means quality, I would say it means both. Why? Because if you make any... First of all, there are a lot of things that cause you... See, person's life... A quality of life that we could understand, okay? A quality of life that we could understand, that if you make correct decisions and everything works out for you, you're definitely going to have a good quality where you don't have problems. But also longevity, because the thing is what takes away from longevity is really two things. One is you live incorrectly physically. Okay? Okay, but that most people are aware of, especially in modern society, even though there were societies that they didn't. So they lost out on longevity because they didn't analyze what is physically healthy. But in modern times, more or less, we have that idea. But what people don't realize is that conflict also takes away from life, you see. Certain conflicts, you see, when you're unhappy, the conflict draws, you know. You ever see, like, for instance, Carter, President Carter. You looked at him when he went into the presidency and when he left the presidency. You saw, like, in 4 years, the man became an old man, you know. Like, you see tension, unbelievable tension. Has its effect on the human being, you see? So the thing is that since the purpose of Torah is to remove conflict, so definitely it'll also give you the longevity. Besides, it will teach you how to analyze the physical. I mean, a lot of people don't know how to make decisions. There's so many different approaches to health, what people have, what could they call health, that you don't know how to make a decision. Well, what the Torah will do will train you how to analyze these things and how to make the decisions so that you can be able to find the truth. So in these ways, the Torah gives you longevity. You see? Life means both, to be both the quality of life and the longevity of life. To live this way, at this point, you might start thinking this way in everyday life. But as you develop your thinking process through the study of Torah, which we're starting in Mishlei and Proverbs, but I mean all areas of Torah work with the training, with thinking and working in thought. And as you develop, and we're also talking only about ethics at this point. So the thing is, in all aspects of ethics, as you start gaining knowledge, you start learning to think this way, and then you start creating your own methods of analysis. What I mean is, it's not creating something new, but the thing is that you know how to think, so when you come up in a certain situation where you don't have the principle, you start analyzing the situation. The situation becomes like the verse. Just like you were trained in the verse to abstract the principle of the verse, so you will be trained to abstract what principle is operating here. How should I deal with this situation? And you will learn to abstract the principle of life. So there's a relationship. In other words, even analyzing the verse is a training in analyzing the problems of life. And once you get that method, with the help of all the principles that you already have from Proverbs, so after a while you will be able to think correctly, you see? But it's a matter of again and again, from all different angles in Proverbs, after a while builds up, and then you learn other areas of Torah that deal with ethics, until after a while you see it from all different angles. Is that in the verse it says the product of the wicked is for sin. And we really changed it to failure, okay? The question is, how did we go from sin to failure, okay? The reason why we did that is when we translated to failure, because if I left it sin, I was sure that the approach you would, in other words, you're going to look at it from a certain angle, you know, like sin has certain connotations. And so therefore I gave the interpretation to failure. But however, see, according to our definition now, insofar as ethics is concerned, sin is where I do an act which is irrational. An irrational act must lead to failure. Therefore, sin as a cause, insofar as ethics is concerned, is an irrational act. Sin used as a result would be failure, because if you do an irrational act, the result must be failure. We do see people that live irrational lives, and yet they are successful. Okay? The thing is that many times when you look, sometimes, like for instance, a person has certain symptoms, and we look at it and say, that's not too bad. Doctor looks at it, rushes you to the hospital. Right? Now, the thing is the same thing in the physical world. There's sometimes symptoms which you look at it as a success. But it really isn't, you see? I'll give you an illustration. Let's say, for instance, there are certain things that, first of all, there's success in the five senses. When we, in other words, that we cross the street, we realize it's dangerous, we look both ways. So people are, all people, unless the person is psychotic, but otherwise most people are successful on the physical level. Even the primitives that believed in all types of mystical things, right? But however, they knew they went hunting. The only thing is, they depended on the hunting for their gods, but they did the right thing. You see, they had to do the correct action to actually come down with the completion of the hunt, to capture the animal or to get the animal, you see? So they had to do the correct act, even though they might have prayed to strange gods, you see? But as you start going in more into the subtlety of it, the way they're living their lives, these things are going to affect them. As we study Proverbs, we'll see more and more in what ways these things affect them and how it affects them. You see? But the thing is, yes, on the superficial level, you do see that people are successful, and it also depends on what society. For instance, in our society, we live in a scientific society. It's true that we don't study Proverbs, but they will be successful in finding the
the things, you know, whatever they want to find from science. But as the society becomes corrupt, we're finding that even scientists are sometimes cheap just to get their result and just to get their honor. And so they write that they got something when really they didn't find any discovery, you see? And that's how things start failing, you see? As it continues, the corruption and the emotion, but the thing is, on a certain level, they can be successful. But on the long run, that's why he says that tavur, the Hebrew tavur, means the product. The product of the, in other words, right away, the wicked is successful on the short run, you see? They like, so there was one general that says, why was Hitler successful with the Blitzkrieg? Because nobody ever expected such a thing. It was unexpected. He says, but it's not very difficult to break a Blitzkrieg, and after a while they did. You see? But it's only because they didn't expect it at the beginning, you see? But slowly, but you understand, then you could work it out. And therefore a person should have to change his tactics, which Hitler couldn't. You see? So therefore, the thing is that there are many, many different things that the wicked can be successful on a short run. You must see how, on the short run, how it fits into reality. To be even successful, it must be some reality. He's doing something in reality. But the only thing is, what you don't notice is that the long run, as he's taking these steps and being successful, so he holds the way of his wickedness and those emotions are correct, and in the long run, that's where he will be destroyed. Look at the wicked, when they are successful, you should analyze what they did in line with reality to make them successful. Then at which point their emotions didn't allow them to look at reality correctly and work with a certain way that he's going to fail. There's a certain, in other words, like this. Take Hitler, okay? Now Hitler was successful, he worked in a certain way, he's politically correct, he worked it out politically and the politics, and he worked out the wars and everything like that, okay? But what happened in his first failure? His first failure was really in Russia, okay? Now, what happened when he came into Russia, he had the Blitzkrieg, but however, he didn't capture... Now, the Blitzkrieg is moving very quickly, so he spread over a long parcel of land, okay? So what happened is he did not capture all of Russia. In fact, he was within a few miles of Leningrad, at that time the capital, when the winter came in, the Russian winter, you see? And he was spread out over very, very, around 300 miles. And his general says, let's retreat 300 miles for the winter and consolidate. And then after the winter, if we protect ourselves over the winter and we stick it out during the winter, so then we can get back to 300 miles right after the winter in the spring, just go and take over. But Hitler says, we will not give up one inch of German territory. You see?
Russian territory.
German. Now he called it German territory.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Right. Now the Russian territory was now German.
Okay,
he says, I will not give up one inch of German territory.
Okay,
you see? So the thing is that he was spread over a long piece. So they brought in troops from Siberia who were dressed in white down, so you couldn't see them. And also they were warm while the Germans weren't. The guns were oiled for that type of weather. And they just took them off piece by piece because they were spread out, and by the time the winter was over and the spring came, the Germans were already weakened already, and then the rest is history, you see? So the thing is that he did have a plan, you see, and he worked out, and it was a good plan, but his emotions, see, the emotions, what happens is always the emotions get in line, getting there, and just, that's what happens to the wicked. See, that's how the wicked destroy themselves. Their emotions affect them. There are some wicked people that are not thinkers. We will talk about those people that are simply not thinkers. But however, there are many wicked people that are really thinkers and they think things through. But however, it's when their emotions get involved there that... And also, you have to understand that sometimes the circumstances, like Hitler was in a circumstance, you see, there's outside circumstances, where what happened was is the other nations made terrible mistakes. See, the mistake was is that they made a mistake and they thought that if you satisfy evil for a little bit, that'll satisfy them, it'll go away. You see? But evil was never satisfied, and you got to stop them right away. So he was successful by virtue of the mistakes of the rest of the world. You see? Because the rest of the world just backed off.
They say, okay, we'll give you that piece of land. Just leave us alone. We don't want to go into battle. But they don't realize that evil, you know what I mean? Once you back off from evil, evil feels successful. Success, then we move in. You see, then we continue. So therefore, he was successful for two reasons. One is a certain amount of thought, okay? And two, because the rest of the world was also making mistakes. And this is, in the beginning of the situation, their mistakes made them fail. As we look at the wicked person as a success, it's a big mistake. The success, if you look deep enough, is only a symptom that you can't, that you don't really see. And you think, oh, wow, you'll only look at it superficially on the physical and the physical part. You see? But if you look underneath, you see failure is coming. Introduction. Sometimes you have a verse that deals with a particular case. Sometimes you have a verse that gives you an introduction to the whole picture of what's going on in Proverbs. I looked at the verse, I really thought I'd give an introduction until we work it out. And then I realized this verse was the introduction. This verse, as we say, like this. The subject matter of the verse is actions. Okay? And there are two types of actions. There are thought-out actions, and there's ignorant actions, where you don't have all the facts, you don't have all the ideas, it wasn't thought out every single step. That's an ignorant action. So therefore, we say thought-out actions leads to success or to life, and the ignorant actions that the wicked will lead to failure. There's two ways of reading the verse. So what we're going to do is give both ways of reading it, and then we'll analyze both each way. Then we'll analyze each one separately. Okay? As the path to life is guarding Musa, comma, and he who leaves Musa will err, E-R-R. As a way of life, the either training your mind to see the correct view of life, or Musa is to investigate the emotions and see precisely how they make mistakes. That is Musa. Musa is the study of life. In other words, two things. One is how to get the correct views of life, or to deal with the emotions that don't allow you to see or to see the correct views or to act upon the correct views. Then you deal with the emotions. That's Musa. That's all that is included in Musa. It says the path to life is guarding Musa, and he who leaves Musa will err. Life is guarding Musa and leaving false Musa. This word to err, it could be translated as either err or false. Try to compare the proverbs. Each proverb, even though they come from the same verse, should be analyzed totally separate as a separate entity. There were two different commentaries that understood the proverb differently, and each one will be analyzed in its own right. Okay, don't try and make any comparisons. What is the path to life? What he means by the path to life, he means the best possible life that the physical world has to offer. If you want the best possible life that the physical world has to offer, this is the verse for you. We're dealing with halacha, or Jewish law, and the answer is no. We are not dealing with law, we're dealing with practical, everyday life. It was created for the human being. In other words, the human being has free will to be guided either by his intellect or by his emotions. What I mean is not that you get rid of one or the other, but which one makes the decision in your life. For instance, emotions, you make decisions by jealousy, by vengeance, by greed. All these type of emotions tell you how to make decisions. Rationale will show how these decisions are irrational and lead to some type of destruction. Okay?
So therefore, what the Mussar is, it shows you, well, this verse will discuss a lot what Mussar is, but it'll show you the best possible life and show you the incorrectness of the other type of life. Comparing Mussar to Halacha would be comparing math to physics. They do have something in common. I mean, they have a point where they meet, but they are two different sciences. The same thing, Mussar and Halacha definitely have some meeting point, but however, they are two different sciences and two different approaches. Between Mussar and philosophy, I would say that this is Mussar is ethical philosophy. It's a particular area. The ethical philosophers didn't have anything good to say. Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. But however, here in Torah, if you follow ethical philosophy of Torah or Mussar, so then you will, have 3,000 generations of the greatest thinkers that are interpreting the Word of God, you see. So therefore, they have every single angle covered. It's hard to miss the real approach and what really ethics is in reality. Can't miss. 3,000 generations, 3,000 or 3,500 years. So what does it mean to err? What it means to err means that you will suffer the consequences of your actions. What we're doing is most people know that, let's say, for instance, you go out without, in 20 degrees weather, you go out in a bathing suit, that you're going to pay the consequences. Well, if you go out in the sun the first day of summer and you're light skin, you're going to pay the consequences. But most people look at jealousy and all these emotions as something bad, but they don't see it as really leading to consequences and harm. You see? That's what it means. It means if you leave Mussar, if you don't accept Mussar, then what's going to happen is you're going to live by your emotions and you will pay the consequences. Even so, and because you don't have the knowledge of Mussar, many times you're paying consequences, you don't even realize that you are the cause. And that's when you start blaming other things around you. You don't even realize you're the cause. Halfway, either you live the life or you don't live the life. But the only thing is that as you start living the life, you protect yourself from certain consequences, but where you haven't corrected your way of life, it is possible that you will suffer the consequences. That missing out on the good life, you can have a life of consequences where your actions now could in 5-10 years affect you. You learn to make decisions. You train yourself to make decisions in a certain way, right? You know your life. You train yourself. But in different situations, you react in a certain way. And when given the right situation, that reaction could be very harmful. But since you trained yourself to react that way, let's say, for instance, you react every time something doesn't go your way, you get angry. Okay, so you have fights with your wife or this or that. But let's say one time you lose yourself and you beat up on your boss. You can go to prison and lose your job. But you trained yourself to think that way and to react that way. It's going to come out in a situation where you're going to pay the consequences real big. And you don't raise them correctly, there's going to be problems later on. And you don't know why. You say, look, I did everything right. But if you really don't know all the areas of how to live correctly and how to make decisions, how to relate to people, how to relate to children, you definitely are going to make errors. And so therefore, there will be consequences. The point was, the question that was asked is, what does it mean to guard? Really should say to study Mussar, not to guard Mussar. Well, what is this guard Mussar that you study? Let's say even halacha. So you study halacha and then you carry it out. You do the act. But in Mussar, since we're dealing with deep emotions, emotions that we're not even aware of, we have to, and these emotions have ways of coming out in very tricky ways. And therefore, you have to be constantly on your guard to watch that even when you're thinking correctly, it could affect your thinking process. You know, without realizing, it affects how you make the decisions. And that's what it means to guard. In other words, it's not a matter of saying, I know I have to do this, A-B, but you're working out things in everyday life. And as you're thinking about it, your everyday life is, your emotions are being, wants to make the decision. You don't want it to. And so therefore it sneaks out. through even your logical thought, it could sneak out and make these decisions and these patterns that you don't recognize, the way you operate and the way you make decisions, start sneaking out. Therefore, you have to guard mussy. You have to be very, very careful to watch yourself every single time when you think it through, that I, and to think it through again and to test it out. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, the greatest thinker in the past generation, said that a person should always discuss things with his rabbi. He says, what if you are the greatest thinker of the time, which he happened to have been? So he says, what should you do? You don't have anybody greater than you to think about, to talk it over. He says, talk it over with your students. Why? Because sometimes, if it's your emotion, you might be a very great thinker, but if it's your emotion, you're not going to notice it while somebody else will, even though he's not a greater thinker as you. So another person will notice it. So therefore, it's important to check it over with others and to talk over with other thinkers, I'm talking about, if you talk it over with other thinkers. But that's what it means to guard. To guard means is that these emotions keep coming out. You don't even realize that you don't even realize you're totally living by them. You don't realize that. And you have to uncover these motives and how they work in you and how they operate and to start dealing with them. Deal with it is be aware that there is a part of you that does this. And then to watch it and to start picking up and to noticing, to try and pick up on these ways that you react in different situations that you don't even notice. There's a lifetime process of undoing, you see? It's a lifetime process. Even while you're studying all the other subjects in Torah that are necessary, you must always be involved with this, unless you're like Moshe or Moses, that he undid all his emotions. And that was when he was... Yeah, Jacob undid his emotions when he went down to Egypt. The last emotion, when he was 127. So, practically speaking, for us, it's a lifetime process of constantly being aware that these emotions are always at work and always, and this is what we mean by the evil inclination. You see, that's what we mean by the evil inclination. It's really, it's the part of us that we don't recognize. I'm trying to change the definition of evil. See, this is the problem, okay? For instance, when Jesus says, forgive them, Lord, because they do not know what they are doing, I don't know if I'm quoting correctly, but the thing is that we hold that ignorance, where you do not know, that's evil. It's not where an evil person says, there's nobody in this world says, I am jealous and therefore I'm going to buy a bigger house than him. Nobody said that. You ever hear a person say that? Everybody else knows they're buying it for jealousy except the person. They have all these rationalizations, I need a bigger house, I like my comfort. They have all these arguments. Recognize it. Everybody else does. Many times we have a sense of evil that, oh my God, I'm doing something evil. By us, evil must be defined clearly what makes it evil. Right? And insofar as ethics is concerned, I'm now only talking about one subject of Torah, the subject of ethics. Evil is because you are destroying your way of looking at life, because a person doesn't stay the same. He's constantly getting more, either he's going more in the direction of his emotions or more in the directions of rationale. And he's destroying his view of life if he keeps going in the emotional way. And two, he will get the consequences of his actions. So therefore, that's what we mean by evil insofar as ethics is concerned. We don't say jealousy is bad like it's a catastrophe. It is a catastrophe, but it's not a mystical thing. That's what I'm getting at. It's not mystical. Most of the people hold somehow jealousy is bad. But we say it's not mystical, then it's not somehow. We will show you exactly how it is. And as we go through the different verses, we will show different things, how they are good and bad. In other words, if you do something wrong, you shouldn't condemn yourself like I'm terrible. The guilt feeling when you do something wrong should only force you to reanalyze and to check over and to think through what the mistake was and then to work and correct it. Guilt feeling and bad feelings in and of themselves is no benefit. It's only a benefit only if it helps you and it motivates you to get involved in the world of thought. So therefore, if you feel guilty about something, you shouldn't stay in that state, but you should say, just one minute, what did I do wrong? Let me analyze and let me see if I could find the source of what the error is and see if I could correct it. And let me define what the error is and why it is wrong and what makes it wrong. You see? These things must all be defined clearly to the mind. That is practically the cure. This recognition is the cure of undoing the evil inclination or our emotions making decisions for us. All of these things take constant review of these ideas and these verses. Constant review again and again until like you naturally start thinking this way. And then you can start guarding the emotions because you have the ideas. And these ideas are part of you, so you become very aware of them. View, and sometimes in the review you will find new questions. You must have every question answered. If there's any new question, write it down and it should be answered. If it's not clear to you, and then it can't operate. If it's not clear to your mind, then the idea is not operative. It will not operate within you. They're saying that the path to life is to God, Musser. So then what does it mean to leave Musser? It means even if you study it but you don't guard it, then you will make mistakes. Then the value of the value of Musser is lost even if you study it. You see? In other words, like this, if we're to define the verse, we would say the subject is Musser. Well, how a person should relate to Musser, right? And how people relate to Musser. You could either guard Musser. In other words, you have the study and it's constantly being used in all your decisions, or you don't have it, meaning that you could have studied. If you didn't study Musser, then you don't have it. That's it. But even if you studied Musser, but if you don't guard it, then you don't have it, and it will be lost. Science of mathematics, where you just study math. You just have the ideas of math. It must be constantly guarded to make sure. And every time you're making decisions and thinking through, it must be guarded to make sure it's a rational decision and you protect yourself from all the possible consequences. The second way we interpret this verse, and we're saying the path to life is, what is the path to life? Guarding Musser and leaving false Musser. Of a false Musser, isn't that an oxymoron? The first way we interpreted the verse was how you relate to Musa. The second proverb is really saying, what is the subject of Musa? What is the subject of Musa? The subject of Musa is two things. One is there are many, many people that tell you how to live. See, Musa is ethical philosophy where they tell you how to live. And if you read magazines, there are plenty of people that want to tell you how to what they do and how you should do things, and they tell you how to live, and they're psychiatrists, and they have actors and actresses, and all different people want to tell you how to live, you see. Now, it's not enough just to know correct Musser, but you must also know why these are false, because these are the type of things that are going to affect you. And the thing is that you must have both. In other words, you must have the ability. The subject of Musa is not one-sided. It is knowing the correct idea and knowing the false idea and knowing why it is false. And if you notice, all of Proverbs, all of Mishlei, is set up that way. They have the correct view of life and the incorrect view of life. Mm-hmm. You see? And then we discuss why the incorrect view of life is incorrect and what harms you will get from it and what's the benefit of the correct. Because you must have that comparison and you must see. And if you see, also, even in the guarding of Musa, if you recognize a fault, what's wrong, then you could look into your own emotions to recognize if you have it. But if you don't know if a thing is a fault, you don't know why it's a fault, you don't even know, you won't even recognize it if you're doing it. You won't recognize that area. What we're doing is opening up, what Mishlei is doing is opening up all areas that you didn't even realize was right or wrong. And certain things that you thought was right, you're going to find out is wrong. Certain things that you find out was wrong is really right. So the thing is that you must know both sides. Because if you don't know what's wrong, you don't know how to protect yourself. So therefore, what he's saying is the subject of Musa is you must know a correct way of life and the incorrect way of life. The incorrect way is incorrect. So that helps you deal with the emotion too. Because once logically you see it's incorrect, so then naturally you will turn away from it because nobody wants to harm themselves. of interpreting this verse. The question is, the first way is, how should you relate to Musar, namely by guarding it? Or is the subject, what is the subject of Musar? What is the subject? What do you deal with? What are the objects that you deal with in this subject? And namely, you deal with two objects, the correct view and the incorrect view. In other words, let's say I'm studying mathematics. I only have to have the correct proof. I don't care if I have 20 incorrect proofs, it won't affect me. But unless I must know the incorrect desires, because I might have it, I might not be even aware that I have it. And I might not even be aware that it exists in me. So therefore I must know about this to be aware of it, to be able to guard it. What it means to guard yourself, okay? And we want a little clarification on guarding, what it means by guarding Musa. Right? Now the thing is that in everyday life we find that people act according to their emotions. They make decisions based on different emotions and sometimes even unconscious emotions. Emotions that we're not aware of, and there's things that we say and do that just come out just by virtue of the natural human being. So things come, either actions or statements come out because of the unconscious. Now, therefore, we have to constantly be aware of what we're doing. Insofar as the science is concerned, you study the science, you define it, you clarify it until the mind sees it clearly, then you're finished. But insofar as Musa is, after you study the science, then you have to watch yourself, how you operate, to make sure these things, these unconscious things, don't come out in your actions and in the way you think, how it affects your thinking. You have to be aware of all these aspects of yourself. That's what it means, guard. Because it's constantly there, and therefore you have to constantly guard it. 18, and verse 18 says, he who covers hatred is lying lips, and he who brings out false as anger is a fool. So in this verse, either you're a fool or you're lying lips. That's your choice. So what does it mean to hide hatred? Lying lips. Your anger. I want to say that the subject of the verse is anger. Okay? And so therefore, if the verse is anger, then we have to know the two ways that these people are dealing with anger. There's one called a lying lips and one is a fool. What's the difference? Seems like there's two ways of having an outlet for anger, and we want to know what's the difference. He is of the first half, where he hides anger, is that it's lying lips because even though he talks nicely to the other person, so then but he really doesn't mean it. He's really lying to him because in actuality he's harboring hatred within him. And he's only talking nicely to him on the outside for social reasons. Is that your possibility? Right? Okay. The thing is, if a person actually did that only for nice reasons, that person would be a fool. Because the guy is living a life of suffering. He has anger, and he has no outlet for that anger, and he's acting nice to you, which causes more anger, which the anger build up, the guy would totally suffer. That he wouldn't call lying lips. I assume he would call him a fool. Because the guy, that's a real, he's just suffering, nobody else is suffering except him. So therefore, that would be a fool. Second possibility, that he's lying so that he should act nice to you, so that he should take vengeance for this real harm that you did, or fake harm, whichever it is. But the thing is the hatred brings out vengeance, and what the lying lips are, is he's covering it up until he could take his vengeance. That would be the first half. Verse is talking about, Doug is right, that the second half of the verse is talking about that the person brings out his anger means that he explodes, he gets angry, and he screams and yells at you. Why is he a fool? Fool is because now the other person knows to be wary and to be careful of this person, because now he knows he's an enemy. So therefore he should be careful of the person once he knows he's an enemy. I don't know to be careful of a person who I don't know is an enemy. And I'm not aware that I have to be careful. But however, a person that is angry with me and shows his anger So then I know to protect myself, and the person could never harm me. So he could never have an outlet for his anger. In other words, a person that doesn't show his anger, the first possibility which we rejected, is a person in conflict. The person that is angry and just gets his anger off, just to get it off, so he got his anger off, but however now he forewarns the other person to be careful of him. The third person stops to realize that if he shows that the guy will be aware of him, that he's angry with him, so he covers up his anger and he talks to him nicely until he gets his moment for vengeance. About a practical, very practical consequences. I understand there are other connotations that a person screams and yells and all the things of evil that we talk about throughout Mishle. We always mention, we always show the consequences. What we're showing here is that there are two ways for an enemy to react to you. Somebody that hates you to react to you. And therefore the intelligent person will know how to deal with the second half. But however, the first half, even the intelligent person will not know that he's dealing with an enemy, and so therefore that's why we call it lying lips. In other words, his consequences will be from other verses in Mishle, which we've discussed, or in different times, the consequences of evil in general. And he will get the consequences of evil. But in the practical situation, it could be that he could hurt you because you're unprepared for it. But however, if a person shows his anger that he's upset with you, so then you can protect yourself. So this advice is to the intelligent person, not how to deal with his own anger and what the harm of your own anger is, but however, the two types of expressions of anger and how to protect yourself against them. Difficulty of protecting yourself against an intelligent, evil person, the difficulties of that. For clarification on that verse, okay? The first person is harmful to others because he contains his anger. And therefore, he uses thought. He thinks it out how the best way to get even to the other person. That's the first one. Okay? That's the way he operates. The second person is a fool because he's harmful to himself. Why? Because he doesn't contain his anger. He immediately shows his anger. And therefore, the other person recognizes it, and there's no thought at all. It's immediate expression for his anger. And therefore, the other one is protected. Now, as a corollary to this, we want to show that the only possibility for success is where you use thought or wisdom. Now, here's an evil person, and the first half of the verse is talking about an evil person, and he uses thought to be successful. And you see, insofar as he thinks things through, he is successful. Insofar as he's a liar, then there are other verses to show his downfall and how, in actuality, he will destroy himself. But on the short run, we see that the evil person that thinks will be more successful than the evil person that doesn't think. And that it becomes a proof to show that success is only through thought. And of course, the person that realizes that will stop and think about evil itself and realize the destruction of evil, so then he would never harbor the hatred, or if he would, he definitely won't have an outlet for it. He'll see that it's evil, and he'll protect himself against doing evil, because he'll see the destruction in himself. That would be the final, that would be the ultimate wisdom. But however, if you have a little bit of wisdom, then you can be partially successful in your evil. In fact, I would say the only way you can be successful in your evil is only through thought. This would be, therefore, it is dangerous to try to teach an evil person knowledge, because it'll only help him in his evil. 19. With many or a lot of words, you will not stop from sinning. And he who controls his lips is a thinker. A lot of words. You could say a lot of words there. He wouldn't tell you that that's going to cause sin if you're talking in Torah, right? On the contrary, you know, so it doesn't mean a lot of words. Mm-hmm. Sinning. I mean, you do anything, or is it a particular type of thing? In other words, do you have a particular type of sinning in mind? the expression, a lot of words, you will not stop from sinning. As you just said, with a lot of words, you will sin. What does it mean with a lot of words, you will not stop from sinning? What does it mean to control your lips? Thinker, insofar as controlling his lips are concerned, you don't have to be a thinker to control your lips. A person that covers hatred is lying lips, which means that he controls what he really feels, right? And now we're saying the same thing about a thinker, that he controls his lips. What is the difference between the control of a thinker and the control of the lying lips? Of verse 18. Is that insofar as a thinker is concerned, he thinks about, at least he thinks about his thoughts. That was the first possibility. He thinks about his thoughts. Okay, it just doesn't just come out. But the thing is, that doesn't help us much if I don't have a guide what to think. Just to think about what I'm saying, I mean, I can become neurotic that way, constantly watching myself, everything I say, unless I have some type of a guide what we're talking about. What am I watching for? It's not just watching, you see, it has to be a guide. What's the guide, you see? If the verse doesn't tell me the guide, then it doesn't help me much. What does it mean by a lot of words? What type of a sin would a person commit by speaking a lot of words? How does a lot of words, how does the quantity of words make a person sin? He thinks in a certain way, that which is, and he has an idea, so he tells over that the idea. Now the thing is that there's a certain amount that is necessary to get the idea across. Now once you start speaking more than that, right? So then the question is where is that coming from? It's not rational to talk that. If it's not rational for the extra, where is it coming from? You say? Therefore, it must be coming from the unconscious part of the human being. You say? See, a lot of people just like to talk. See, if you're talking about a person, there's two types of talk. There's some people that just like to talk. Even if they're not talking Lashon Hara or any other the type of things that are sinning, that you're not allowed to talk. Okay? But however, if a person just rambles on, it must be from his unconscious. So therefore, if it's from his unconscious, then it's impossible that there shouldn't be something come out. You see, in other words, that's why I think it says that he doesn't stop from sinning. He didn't say sinning. Why? Because his intention is not to sin. He's not going at it. He's watching himself. He's not talking gossip. He's not talking lies. He's not exaggerating. He's not none of these things, okay? But if he's just rambling on, even though his intention is not to sin, it is impossible not to. Why? Because the thing is that once you allow the unconscious its freedom, that is the area of sin. Like I said, you say a person is born wild. A person is born with the emotions are evil, basically, and it is the mind that has to recognize and to define what is good and what is not. Attention to sin, you see. But let's say I'm just rambling on. I just feel like talking. I'm not doing anything wrong. But since I am rambling and my mind is not dictating what to say, so the information that is coming must be, or the cause of the things that I'm talking about must be my unconscious, my emotions. Once it's stemming from there, then it's impossible that I'm not going to say the correct thing. I have to say the incorrect thing. Something will come out wrong. Even if it's in the study of Torah. I'm studying Torah, and then I just have to clarify for the audience what is correct. But if I start rambling on about the information beyond which the student needs, so then the question is, why should I talk about, why should I continue on? There's no more clarification, why should I continue on? Therefore, I'm being dictated not by my mind what is rationally necessary, but I'm being dictated by an emotion. Once I'm dictated by the emotion, that's where the danger comes. Whenever the emotion has control, then it's impossible not to sin. It's going to come out. You see? nature of that sin. Okay. See, what happens is that, let's put it this way. You ever notice somebody starts with a joke? If you're in a group of people, somebody cracks a joke, like, and everybody just naturally, you know, gets in the mood for joking, naturally it's going to come to a dirty joke. Right? It doesn't stop. Once you allow your emotions to go, it always goes too far. You see what I mean? If you're just talking about people, just talking, suddenly you're gossiping. It's the most natural thing in the world. Because this is the desire of the emotion. The specific sin which you're going to talk about, that we're not, we don't know. But as long as you have an opening, allow the emotion's freedom, and especially by talk, usually by an action, a person feels by an action, that an action he know how to do. You know, I can't punch you in the face. There's a control there. But by speaking, there's no guard. Like, what's the difference? What am I saying? I'm just saying words. Before I'm saying words, and now I'm saying words. What's the big deal? I'm not doing anything. People usually don't think they're doing anything with words. You see? My son Shmuley one time told me, he says, you notice that a person always stops for a full stop or a red light. He says, but when he's traveling, he naturally will go above the speed limit. He says, what's the difference? Because one is a qualitative difference. I'm stopped, then I'm going. That's a qualitative difference. Then a person won't make a mistake. But when there's a quantity, whether I'm going 35 or 40, that, you know, I mean, it's only a quantity. People don't make distinctions in quantity. Now, talking, people just look at talk as, you know, there's nothing wrong in talking. What did I do? I'm only talking. I didn't mean it. You know what I mean? I'm only talking. An act, that's something else. An act is a qualitative thing where you could see you're doing harm to a person. But in a speech, people don't look at it that way. And once they allow it, then it just keeps coming and coming. Salesmen, they always tell a salesman, once you make the sale, stop. Don't talk, because you can only talk yourself out of it. You see? A wise person knows what is necessary to say, whatever subject it is, whether it's business, Torah, discussion, there's always, he knows when he got his point. Now, if there's a question, so then he'll deal with the question. But he'll only deal exactly with the point that is necessary. He just doesn't ramble on just to hear himself speak, but he has a definite clear-cut goal in mind what there is to say. And once he says it, then that's it. You see? In 18, we're dealing with anger. Anger. And there's two ways to deal with anger. Either you can control it, and, you know, like we spoke about last week on the tape. Over here, we're talking about talking. Not anger. I'm just talking. Okay? Now, the thing is when there's talking without a purpose, without a guide, that's the first half of the verse. You see, there's no guide. Second half is talking that there's always a purpose. It's always thought out, what is my purpose for saying anything? You see, whenever there's speech, you see, the subject over here is speech. But the question is there's two ways of speaking. Either I just speak without any purpose, without any plan, without anything. Or there is a purpose. What is my purpose? Once I reach that purpose, then there's nothing more to say. You see? So therefore, that's the subject. The subject is the speech. And the two sides is guided or unguided. Way of explaining the thinker is via purpose. Because once you have a purpose, so then you know when your purpose is fulfilled, then you can fulfill it. It's clear to the mind when your purpose is fulfilled. But if you have no purpose for speaking, and you're just talking, see, then there's room, always room for the unconscious to come out and go too far. That's what I'm saying. In other words, you could manage, you know, for a short time. But once you allow it without a guide, without control, it's going to go too far. He is pure spirit.